the OTB Podcast Network.
And you're very welcome along to a very special edition of OTB AM. It's Gerry Gilroy here. And also with us this morning, we have Owen Sheehan, I presume. Owen, how are you?
Very well, Ger. Any crack?
I'd say the absence of crack is the characterization of exactly where we are at the moment, right?
I thought you were going to say the absence of crack is the crack. And you were going to give us some sort of twee sentiment about creating our own crack.
Okay, we should create our own crack, Owen, as you know, the absence of crack. I mean, it's a glorious sunny morning. Everybody had an hour's less sleep at the weekend, which might have been the worst thing that possibly could have happened for their psychological well-being. I don't know how you felt about that.
I would happily trade an hour's sleep for an extra hour of brightness in the nighttime. That is the one tiny bit of positivity we can take. Is that the weather has been actually very good over the last couple of weeks, and it's going to get better, and we are facing into a summer, which may seem like a longer summer than ever, because we might be trapped indoors for the next couple of months. But that is the one tiny sliver of positivity. We're looking to look at a glass and say that it is half full this morning. Then that is your nugget of happiness for now. The brightness.
You're a fan of the grand stretch.
Oh, who isn't a fan of the grand stretch? I will say this, there is a lack of the grand stretch aroma in Dublin City. I will say that. The grand stretch aroma involves things like, it could be unpleasant farm smells. It could be just freshly cut grass. Those two things, you do get freshly cut grass in Dublin, obviously, as well, but nowhere near the level you would down at home for anybody who's not from Dublin. So the grand stretch comes with all the sights of the grand stretch, great sunsets, all that sort of thing. But without the smells, unfortunately.
I thought that you were going to say the smells were sweat from the amount of tops that get taken off from the slightly pudgy Irish male who decides, now, grand stretch in the evening now, I'm taking my top off like a Newcastle fan.
Well, you see, that usually comes later in the summer, doesn't it? The grand stretch is usually a phenomenon of March into April. And then it's really when the weather, when we have a heat wave, when something tips into 18 degrees Celsius, that's when the tops start coming off. That is the third in the holy trinity of Irish summertime aroma. Yes, it's the smelly Irish male.
Yeah, on the stoops in the ghetto. Can I just ask you, Owen, yesterday we were obviously recording the Classic Game Club, which nearly killed me. It's the 1998 All-Ireland Football Final, which we're going to get to a little bit later on. But you made the point that this was supposed to be League Sunday yesterday.
Yeah, it was actually. In kind of thinking about this yesterday, or last week, I should say this, our minds would certainly have been focused on something far, far, far less important last week had the world not been challenged by the coronavirus at the moment. And it was supposed to be League Sunday yesterday. It was going to be a glorious day for football. It was going to be a big enough weekend of sport, actually, by what I can look at. I think I saw, I saw something from the Kerryman, I think, tweeting about how in an alternate universe right now, David Clifford has just scored a 74th minute winner in front of 50,000 people in Croke Park against Galway in the league final. That's what yesterday was supposed to be. Like, I'm sure I'm not the only person in thinking, oh, this is the weekend that was supposed to be on, just to try and take your mind off things at the moment. But that was it. Like, that's actually one of the interesting things is that I think the passage of time is still happening unbeknownst to ourselves at the moment, that all of a sudden, the clocks have gone forward, the grand stretch, as we said, league final Sunday was supposed to happen yesterday. I think I'm not sure, do I just speak for myself here, when the semi-lockdown happened a few Thursdays ago before St. Patrick's Day, I kind of put a pause on life at that point, and I put a pause on the passing of time. We're actually in the background, time is ticking away, and all of a sudden it's going to be like, well, the championship was supposed to start this weekend, and all these sort of summer events were supposed to start this weekend, and that's sort of a weird thing to be thinking about. But yeah, like, and I think when it comes to GEA, it's like, will that competition that was supposed to end yesterday ever get concluded? I certainly have my doubts.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like the league is going to get concluded, but there is some hope, I suppose, is the right word to use. Miguel Delaney had a massive exclusive yesterday about what the Premier League are thinking about when it comes to perhaps potentially finishing the existing season that we're in at the moment. And the details of that are beginning to emerge. And it turns out that they aren't the only league that are thinking about doing this. The Germans are thinking about doing something similar. And the plan seems to be very simple. It's to cocoon as many people as are required to play football every single day for how long it takes to finish whatever amount of games are left in the Premier League season. And they would do this in a couple of venues, one in London, one in the Midlands. They would secure certain hotels, and there would be a match every day behind closed doors, but on TV. And it would obviously happen in June and July. The caveat to all this is that the curve in the UK will have to be flattened. There'll have to be a point that they reach where the testing has reached a tipping point where they're clear and they're confident enough that this could happen. But on the face of it, is this idea so crazy that it might just work?
Possibly. I think it was going to... I don't think this is too dissimilar to something you were chatting about, really, in the last couple of weeks, that if we accept that there was too much money in football for it to not reach some sort of conclusion, then it was always going to result in something like this. And I know this is a report in the London Independent. There is no official line from the Premier League just yet, but you'd assume that it is something on this level of madness that has to be considered for anything to go ahead. Now, there's a couple of things, and it's mentioned in Miguel's piece. First of all, you would have to have seen proper data that the curve has been flattened in the United Kingdom, that there is less of a threat from COVID-19 than there currently is. Whether or not you can actually get that level of assuredness from scientists and from medical professionals in the next couple of months, it's still very much remains to be seen. And I think it's actually a little bit fanciful that you might be able to get that in, say, the next two and a half months, because it's not just the process of playing these games from the moment of safety. It's a moment of safety, and then you can start planning this, and you can start quarantining people. You need to test everybody. You need medical professionals there. In the piece, it's mentioned, what if somebody does their cruciate and needs to go to a hospital? Will they be safe? There are a multitude of different questions that come with this, not least the one that if one person gets infected, that is a domino that would collapse this entire thing. So is there answers for those questions? Well, I'm not sure there is. I'm not sure, can you actually go ahead with something that has that risk of one person gets infected and the whole thing is done? It just needs to be unbelievably stringent, and the amount of staff you would need to carry out something like that is huge, and the UK can't afford to dedicate any medical staff to something like this at the moment. They will be able to dedicate medical staff to other things eventually. Like, what are we thinking here, June, July? I just think even the idea of June at this point, like, we're in April now, in 2 months' time, will the UK be able to dedicate medical staff to something? I'm not sure. Like, if you're talking about July, August as a mega league, and then starting next season up in October, perhaps that's more of a realistic prospect. But it is mad. It's like, you're talking about like World Cup style camps, but there would be quarantine camps, basically, where all your movements are very much controlled. You will be in isolation, as you say, cocooned, but with your teammates and with, I would imagine, a controlled number of staff.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it seems to make a lot of sense. And certainly I'd say this is exactly what the NBA must be thinking about, where there are much smaller teams of people that you would require. You can have, pardon me, local broadcasts, technicians and local announcers who are quarantined and who might be happy enough to go in and do a month and then come out for a month and then get somebody else going. So like, you can begin to see ways that some normality might return to the world of sport. And just given that the smallest, silliest videos at the moment are all doing 6 million views on Twitter, the appetite is out there for people to watch a bit of live sport.
Well, without question. I think that when you talk about the fact that this is going to be a financial decision, that there are television companies who paid huge swathes of cash to actually screen the Premier League on their TV, well, if they get something this summer, if those television companies get some football on their channel this summer, you might imagine that the ratings could be bigger than ever. So absolutely, there is a thirst for it. The NBA, as you mentioned, could be another league that has the possibility of doing this, given the small numbers. Like, there were just so many questions about this. And like, it's just interesting to see how the Premier League even approached this on a PR point of view, because you would need to make movements on this pretty soon and to allow it to be a fluid thing. Is it a little bit of a tense subject to be talking about now? Because you do have to get medical professionals to sign on the dotted line, right? Or you do have to get people to actually ensure that they will be in certain places at certain times in a few months. Is that just a little bit of a sensitive topic at the moment? In the UK, I would have thought it is. Like, how late can you leave it before you organise it is what I'm wondering.
You can build contingency plans, right? So all of the clubs have their own medical staff. There are, I've no doubt, plenty of hotels that would be interested in being involved in this. Mm. The venues themselves should be easy enough to fix and sort out. So you can make the contingency plans. And that's actually the job of the people who work in the Premier League, to try and come up with a way of saving last season and saving the, Miguel uses the word pyramid, I think, to talk about the German clubs. And like, that is the top of the pyramid that the money that the rest of English football requires to survive is going to come from. So, look, this is not important, right? This is where that goes without saying. However, some form of normality returning to life in the form of football, where they find a way under the current circumstances to inject a little bit of normality back into people's lives, might be something that we could look forward to. Again, the UK is going to go through a fairly horrific time over the next couple of weeks, and at the end of that, it might be absolutely ludicrous to be thinking about this. But in the meantime, this story broke last night, and it's a brilliant bit of journalism from Miguel to get the story, and then also to just back it up by the fact that this is also being considered in other leagues around Europe. That perhaps this is a model that might be used. And here's the thing, Owen. It's possible that this might be the model for next season, that it doesn't work this time at all, but that in September and October and November, this is how football is played, and that last season is completely wiped eventually, and a decision is taken that next season, this is how they're going to play. And this might be what the future of football looks like until a vaccine is found or herd immunity exists for various countries. Like, how is European football going to come back? How does the Champions League come back in its current guise with the way that the situation is so fluid across Europe?
Yeah, it's an interesting point of view, because who knows how long you might have a few weeks of, I don't know, like you talk about flattening the curve, but does the curve get extended? Do we have automatically a society that is COVID-19 free? And there is science out there to suggest that that will not be the case. Like, it's interesting when you think about the perhaps power play that this is by the Premier League, that they realise that there is other competing interests in the world of football, not least the Champions League, as you mentioned. And so I think they probably realise that the Champions League faces a far more complicated task to actually get things back underway. Not least with the fact that they now face a PR catastrophe in terms of what happened in the Atalanta-Valencia match, which scientists have called as game zero, almost. The Champions League need to be unbelievably careful before they come back. But kind of similar to how Roland Garros have said, yeah, we're going to take September in tennis. I wonder if the Premier League are almost getting this out there now to ensure that, you know, we've got the summer. Don't you dare step on our patch, UEFA. Even though the European Championships is supposed to be your thing this summer, we've got to get our club seasons finished first of all. And to be honest with you, I think that kind of makes sense. I think countries will be individually able to take control of what they organise sporting-wise before a whole continent will. I think the Champions League, that's got to be scrapped, doesn't it? I think, like,
Maybe. So look, let's play out exactly what you just said here. We'll get into the sports season in one second, but the point you're making about individual countries being able to quarantine, could the remaining 8 teams in the Champions League, or is it 12 teams, could they quarantine in a similar situation to this? Would they be allowed? Would governments decide that, so say, and I'm talking here after the Premier League and the German season, say Germany and England and a couple of other leagues do exactly what is going to happen, and, you know, best case scenario, it's the end of June and most of July that they play these games out, and because you can do it really quick. Is there a possibility that after that, in August, you have a tournament of football where it's in one venue and all the teams come to finish last season's Champions League, and then you can take a pre-season break of 2 or 3 weeks and start next season October time? Is that beyond the bounds of possibility?
No, if you had uniformity amongst the leagues as well, in terms of a method to finish their domestic seasons, it might be possible, because what you could do then is, after the Premier League tournament is finished, you could say to, who's that, Manchester City, right, you're staying in quarantine, you've got your Champions League, and then you have your special pilots, people who are involved in logistics of getting them to their away leg or whatever, not even legs. I think legs are out of the question. I think it'll be one location to play off the Champions League. Wherever you are traveling to, everybody who's taking you to that place obviously needs to have been under the same circumstances of quarantine over the previous weeks to get it down to the minute detail. Like that is the case, right? Like the idea of two-legged quarterfinals, semifinals are now gone. I think it would be almost a festival of football at this point. I hate that phrase, actually. A straight runoff tournament in some location that would actually do it. And maybe the UK is like the guinea pig for that, where it's like we have this place in the West Midlands that has successfully run off a couple of games over the course of a week, and then maybe as a pre-season to next season, you'd be able to conclude the Champions League. So it's definitely a method that you could see it's plausible, 100% plausible. But I do think that any of the normal ideas out there, like returning to normality, almost seems like the most insane thing at the moment. Like, it's almost, as you said at the top, it's so crazy it might work. The crazy things are almost the things that could work better than the normal things, because normality seems so far away at this point.
That's the thing. And I don't envy any of the people who are having to make these decisions, because there is billions and billions of euros and an industry utterly reliant on something happening, and nothing can happen at the moment against the backdrop of horrific stuff in the news. So let's bring in the sports news from this morning. And obviously, it's dominated by the fact that the Premier League could be set to complete the season behind closed doors in June and July, according to documents seen by Miguel Delaney in the London Independent. This season has been suspended until the end of April due to the coronavirus pandemic. And at a meeting last Friday between the Premier League, the EFL and the PFA, there was an agreement that they must try and finish the season despite the difficulties. Being reported that the Premier League is discussing the possibility of the clubs being playing televised games in isolated camps in parts of England over June and July. Meanwhile, Manchester City midfielder Ilkay Gundogan says if the season isn't completed, it would only be fair to award Liverpool the league title. Obviously, they have a 25-point lead at the top of the table and are two wins away from securing the title. Juventus players and coaching staff have agreed to take a wage cut for the next 4 months during the coronavirus pandemic. The agreement is set to be worth around €85 million to the club's wage bill, although an increase in pay would be renegotiated if and when Serie A season is back underway. Katie Taylor's promoter Eddie Hearn is expected to confirm the postponement of the World Champions next bout later on today. The Bray boxer was due to put her undisputed lightweight crown on the line against Puerto Rican Amanda Serrano on the 2nd of May in Manchester. Serrano unofficially announced the postponement of the bout on Twitter over the weekend. Hearn is also expected to announce a rescheduled date for the world title fight. Coming up this morning on OTPAM, we've done the sports pages for you. So we're going to get into the sports pages for you now. We've got our lockdown lowdown coming your way at 8 o'clock. Dermot Lane's going to join us live from Kerry. I don't know if everybody has seen his Lake Regale, which was just aired a couple of weeks ago. But at the end of it, there's kind of this bit where they're talking about what his life is like now. And I think one of the lines is, you know, his day-to-day existence is foraging for edible seaweed and growing his own food so that he can be self-sustainable. And there's almost like a ha-ha element to the narration. Not like that in any bad way, but like, you know, because he's cracked, isn't he? Is kind of the subtext. And now it's like, well, what a great idea that was. So that's coming your way around about quarter past eight. Alan Quinlan talking rugby around about half past eight. And then Classic Game Club, his Galway against Kildare from 1998. The third greatest All-Ireland final of all time. Is that what we decided that was?
According to, I think, Martin Breton in the Irish Independent did a list of the greatest All-Ireland football finals ever. And somehow Galway against Kildare manages to come third in this list. So I think he's obviously leaned on the importance of the finals or the context of the finals and the whole narrative around it, because we recorded this yesterday and there is a lot to talk about when it comes to this All-Ireland final, except for the actual football, which is grand. And like, Galway are really good to watch, but you could watch any other Galway game from this era and say it's as good, or like, I mean, I don't want to talk about individual performances. Like, you've got the Michael Donnellan solo run and all that sort of stuff in this game. So there are, of course, great moments within it. But I just think it's the lore of this Galway team which kind of makes them so special. And the fact that Kildare are in an All-Ireland final within the last 25 years, a novel pairing. So, like, it's exciting. It's definitely exciting to talk about a Galway-Kildare final.
Yeah, in fairness, it is completely radically different from your Commoner Garden Dublin versus Kerry final. That's the point.
Yeah, 100%. And like, one of the things we'll get into later on, like, I mean, I'd be interested to hear from people at home about who some of the greatest lost footballers have been over recent times. Like, the qualifier era has allowed us to scratch the surface in some of the stars from counties that aren't playing Division 1, Division 2 football, for example. But they seriously fell through the cracks before the qualifier series is brought in. And even in counties like Kildare, you even had people who may not have stood the test of time. Like, the Galway team thankfully does, but there's so many 90s footballers, for example, that just do not have the reputation that they deserve despite their talents, because they could have played for a county that were up against a better county in their province and then got knocked out before the business end of every single summer.
Yes, you're apologising for your ignorance of the great Kildare footballers, though, and that's apology accepted on behalf of the Kildare football nation. The fact that you don't know who these Kildare footballers are, but that we did, because, you know, they were our heroes, that's okay. We'll forgive you the fact that you have, like, so many players who were giving out All-Ireland medals in their change, blah, 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 blah. We heard that story. Thanks very much.
I am surrendering. I am surrendering the proverbial white flag.
Let's take you to the sports pages this morning. OTB AM. We're going to start with offtheball.com. The lead story this morning is about Spurs giving permission to Son and Bergwijn to return home. Kim Min-sun is going to go home to South Korea, and Bergwijn's going to return home for the birth of his son. I think Son has been back and forth a couple of times and has ended up being in quarantine on both sides. So I think he's decided to go home for now, which I think would suggest that everybody knows that football is not coming back in just a couple of weeks, and then it's going to be June at the very earliest before any meaningful football is kicked. A couple of other stories there on the homepage for you. We have to use heroes more sparingly. This is the pay-per-view. Vincent Hogan and Kieran Shannon talking about returning medical staff and how worse journalism ends up using the word heroes. And actually, you know, there are genuine heroes in the frontline staff at the moment who are risking their lives for our safety. And maybe we should elevate these people in our society a bit more than we do. Certainly, that seems to be the case, and maybe we're all going to change a little bit after this. Other sports, Tokyo 2020 set to start exactly 1 year later. This is the first report coming through. Big debate going about whether or not we might have a Spring Olympics, or if you can just knock it back exactly 1 year, keep all the bookings. I mean, that would obviously be the easiest thing to do on. Kick it back a single year by the calendar. You change the 2020 to 2021, and everybody goes, oh, okay, my booking stands for next year. It makes the most sense.
Hmm. Yeah, I wonder, does the IOC care about other sports? Like, we've never had a crossover, really, between big football tournaments, which would always be the European Championships, obviously. I wonder if they thought about a spring competition, would they have thought that perhaps it becomes late spring and then perhaps spills into the Euros, and maybe they also had concerns about the worldwide appeal of football taking away from television audiences. So maybe that was part of it, that when you get into July and August, you aren't going toe-to-toe with the biggest sport in the world. So I think that makes sense as well from their perspective, but also, like, it's the summer games, no confusion, let's just do it when it's supposed to be. Everything else under the IOC banner, and I'm talking about the sports and the national governing bodies within all the sports around the world, they will all move for the Olympics. This is what they've all been training for. And I think even for the athletes, it makes more sense, I'd imagine. Like, I presume a lot of them start their cycle from January at the start, or from the start of a season. At least the season kind of feels the same. It feels like a regular Olympic year, and peaking at the right time doesn't seem like this alien concept to do it for spring. It is back to where it normally is.
Yeah, you can literally take the same training regimes and the same qualifying events for people who aren't already qualified, or for events that didn't get the opportunity to do it, and put them back a year. And so it's actually the easiest way for them to make that work. And also, it buys you time. If there's another outbreak in October or in springtime next year, what are you going to do? It's like, well, we can't all of a sudden just have them around that time. So, like, if you're involved in the Olympics, you see the benefit of taking that year and letting everybody else be guinea pigs about what might be able to happen, how easy or otherwise global travel is in the aftermath of this. So there's a lot of things to get into. Billy Joe Saunders is a scumbag is the other main story in the front page of offtheball.com this morning. That's all I'm going to say about that. I'm not going to look that up or talk about it anymore. And a horrific story. Boxer Anthony Yardley's father dies from COVID-19. So you're starting to see very high profile people who are getting the disease in the UK, which again would suggest that the community transmission rates in the UK are very, very high, and that has knock-on impacts with tragic consequences. So they're the main stories on the homepage of offtheball.com this morning. I've got to do the Irish Independent next, is it, I think? I don't actually have the Irish Indo this morning for you, so I can't tell you what's on that.
While you're digging out the Irish Independent, I will move on to the Irish Examiner this morning. I always said that if I was a dub, I'd have been a Northsider. This is Anthony Daly recalling some of his stories as Dublin hurling manager. I was shaking like a leaf with a mixture of nervousness, excitement. That's a new weekly series coming from the Irish Examiner, asking Irish sports photographers to pick their favourite images. Ray McManus is who they're talking with today. And I won't stay at Spurs for the sake of it, says ambitious Kane. So Once you do an Instagram Live with one Jamie Redknapp, your guard tends to go down. And Redknapp got into the heart and soul of Harry Kane yesterday, revealing that it's not definite that he will stay at Spurs. So making sounds that I guess have caused a bit of an overreaction. But then again, there isn't a hell of a lot to talk about at the moment. So you can see why it is dominating a lot of the back pages this morning.
That Anthony Daly story is about his time as manager of the Dubs and Michael Carton, who is a fireman with Dublin Fire Brigade, has obviously tested positive for COVID-19, and Daly's making the point that he's seen Facebook pictures of him where he's back looking well, big smiley head on him was how he described the picture. But he's got a great story about the Northsiders being the ones who were kind of the spiritual core of the Dublin hurling team, which I think we can all accept that like the North Side is the real heart of Dublin, Owen, as an avowed North Sider now, effectively, that's your identity. I know, certainly, that's where I live and North Side rules, basically.
Well, we all know that myself, yourself and Anthony Daly are known worldwide, really, as the Three Musketeers of North Dublin. Anybody exactly. Who crosses over to Liffey is like, this is Owen and Jerran Dalo's territory, really. We're always known for this place. We love the place. The Irish Independent this morning, Joe, I've got that here. A picture of a testing centre at St Union's GA Club in O'Donnell Park, Letterkenny. This will be temporarily suspended today due to a lack of specialised equipment. The HSC is hoping testing can resume tomorrow following the delivery of additional testing kits. Players will take cuts to avoid clubs, says Stephen Ward. He admits pay cuts or wage deferrals are inevitable as football clubs across Europe struggle to cope with the financial impact of the COVID-19 crisis. And Mazzara's probe uncovers €95,000 in FAI payments to Delaney's ex-rights. In Fitzmaurice, payments totaling $95,000, purportedly made from the FAI to a former girlfriend of ex-FAI CEO John Delaney, have been discovered in the Mazzara's probe into FAI affairs. Susan Keegan, who is then in a relationship with the CEO Delaney, engaged with officials from Mazzara's, the consultancy firm hired by the FAI last year to look into the financial affairs of the association. So this is one of those sports stories that will be bubbling along for the next little while.
The Irish Times this morning, they've got their writers to pick their favourite sporting moments, and the headline of Sean Warren's piece this morning is, it's a bit like choosing your favourite child. And there's a great picture of Barney Rock, and I'm sorry, I don't know which of the Dublin footballers it is, cradling a ball just like it was a baby. So the headline mirrors up with the photograph perfectly. And so that's, I think he's picking Dublin Galway in the All-Ireland football final. And they're also looking back at the France versus Brazil 2006 World Cup quarterfinal with Emmett Malone, when a rejuvenated Zizou came alive to oust Brazil. So this was when Zidane basically introduced himself to the tournament properly, because up to that point, it was kind of like, what are France actually doing here? How are they getting here? And then obviously, ultimately, it ends in failure for them in the final when Zidane headbutts Materazzi. But in that game, he was at his absolute very best. So that's their two features on their main page today.
Were you at that World Cup final? You were at that World Cup?
I was at that World Cup final. I was at that World Cup final. I was actually driving, so I missed the Zidane game and never got a chance to watch it back. We were at the other quarterfinal that day. Was it Brazil? No, the Italy Germany game. That was the semi final. So I don't know. I don't know what. I was definitely driving and missed that. So I don't have that memory from the 2006 World Cup, which is really weird. It was like it's that Con Hoolan story of, you know, we went to Italy and missed the World Cup in 1990. You definitely, because you don't get the chance to sit down and watch everything when you're traveling around. Now, the trade-off is you get to go to some of the best sports events that you're ever going to go to. So that Italy-Germany game was in Dortmund, and that was absolutely sensational. Italy win that game. Pirlo is unbelievable. And then saw the final as well. Actually missed the headbutt at the final. So, you know, I mean, how well I was watching it, I'm not sure.
I'm sure you can get it back on YouTube, where somebody can explain to you what happened that year.
I don't really understand. Go on.
The Irish Daily Star this morning is locked in and locked out. Locked in is the story there beside Sergio Aguero. Stars face a month alone in hotel when Premier League matches finally resume. And locked out, Loughnan believes 2020 championship is a write-off. He's convinced there won't be any championships in hurling or football this year, along with the rest of the sporting world of GA have paused their games due to the coronavirus. And Kane's hint at leaving Spurs, as already mentioned, Harry Kane says that he might not hang around at Tottenham Hotspur forever.
The Daily Mirror this morning, Kane and Spurs exit hint. It's almost like Harry Kane is the only story in town. And then they also have this story, TV reality bites for legends. BT star pundits face no pay because of the virus layoff. So they've got a picture of three of the BT stars who apparently are facing into a period of no pay because of what's going on here. And the FA have offered Wembley in the battle against coronavirus. But their headline, it's a good one, Premier Inn. Prem stars may be forced into quarantine hotels for a month to get the season started again. I did see somebody going, oh, the players never agreed to this. How could they have possibly agreed to be away from their families for a month? And you're like, okay, fair enough. I understand that this is a hard sell to the millionaire Premier League footballers who are being asked for a couple of reasons. One, to save their industry, and two, to provide their nation with a little bit of, to provide the nation, whatever country they're doing this in. So if it's German footballers, it's German footballers, and if it's English footballers in England. With the moment of respite from the traumatic news that they're, is it really too much to ask everybody to, like, you know, sit on the couch and go swimming and hang out for a month in a hotel? Is that really too much to ask for a group of people?
Like, it's not actually going to be a Premier Inn. It's going to be wide, sprawling resort. Although, actually, they have mentioned it's going to be the Midlands in England that they will hold this thing. If there is any wide, sprawling resorts in the Midlands in England, I'm not sure do they exist. But, maybe it's a case
of England as well.
I say that again?
Those rich people in the Midlands of England as well, Owen.
True, so they could just perhaps vacate their mansion. Is it a situation where you just say to the players, well, we're not going to dock your pay, like, or we can undo the sort of damage you might be doing to your paycheck over the next little while, like a few clubs saying that they will dock pay for their stars. So, like, you learn your crust by going out and playing in a compact fashion like this. So I can't imagine... Like, you can see the complaint, the obvious complaint is obviously, what is the story of my welfare here? But if it's a situation where everything's safe and they're like, I don't want to sit in a hotel for a week or whatever, perhaps you might have a little less sympathy, but totally accept that there has to be welfare concerns at the moment about following through with this. The Guardian back page leads with a couple of stories from a new documentary made by Pele's daughter, Legend and Warriors, the inside story on a new film about women's football. Sebastian Coe then, meanwhile, many were in mental turmoil. Coe feared for athletes' health if Olympics delay dragged on. And Harry Kane says, scrap season if it is not completed by end of June.
That's exactly the same story in the back page of the London Times this morning. Kane, I could leave if Spurs don't improve, but he also says it's June or bust for Premier League. And boxer's plea after father dies from coronavirus. We've talked about that. Legal tussle over Farah's medical data. This is continuing in the background there. Matt Lawton, the chief sports correspondent of The London Times, is keeping a close eye on what's happening with the Mo Farah situation. And we'll update you on that in a couple of days' time when there's a bit more detail.
The Irish News this morning also has that photo from Letterkenny at O'Donnell Park, a makeshift drive-through testing centre. Conor Moynihan then, only Call of Duty with Breffni men would take me home. So the travelling bug, according to Neil O'Connor here, has well and truly bitten Conor Moynihan since he left Ireland last September. But the Cavan wing-back insists the only thing that could bring him back home in years to come is the pull of Breffni blue.
Okay, I actually don't have any more of the papers on my side. I don't know if you've got any of the rest of them.
Yeah, I'll go through the Sun here. The Sun is my last newspaper this morning. The Irish Sun goes with Kane quit fear, ambitious star won't stay for the sake of it. Premier Inn, gone with that headline as well. Teams lockdown to get games on. And Sancho can go. So this is going to be something. If there's going to be transfer news over the next little while, it's probably going to surround Jadon Sancho. He's been told he can leave by Borussia Dortmund, putting Manchester United and Chelsea on alert. The England winger will not be cheap, as he is valued at £120 million by the Bundesliga club. So that's an interesting one. The whole team could potentially leave, but we'll see how that develops over the next little while.
Just looking up the Telegraph website here, and they're saying that they have an exclusive Newcastle United's £340 million sterling takeover by Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund moves a step closer. So, look, there's been plenty of these stories generally around transfer windows in the past, so we'll wait and see if anything comes of that. And they're also saying that summer rugby is on the horizon as the Premiership presses the reset button. So Premiership rugby, no less than Premier League football grappling with what comes next. So we'll see what happens with that. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. If you want to get in touch with us this morning, you can WhatsApp us. 087-9180-180 is the number. Best place to get us at the moment, obviously, is on Twitter. At OffTheBallAM is the Twitter handler. At OffTheBall, you're listening to or watching OTBAM. We're streaming live on YouTube. We're live on OTB Sports Radio. Best place to get that is the Go Loud app, or of course you can also get us on your Alexa or Google Home. We'll be right back after this.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station. OTB.
Off the couch, live every day at lunchtime across the Off the Ball channels. While we're all staying at home, we want to help you get your daily exercise in. We're bringing you sporting experts with tips and workouts suitable to do at home.
Exercise is not defined to strict parameters. Once you get sweaty and out of breath, it works.
You might be stuck in the house, but let's keep moving and get off the couch.
You can use your couch to elevate your feet if you're lying on your back.
Off the Couch, Off the Ball's new lunchtime fitness program. You can get it on all our social channels and offtheball.com every day from 1 p.m.
OTB. OTB AM.
Well, how fitting that it should come down to these two. Olive in her familiar black, five times the champion. Mabel, the rising star, winner last year. You can see how excited they are, but also feel the tension.
Get on with it.
And here it's in the crowd as we near the start of this final. And now they go, Olive away first, but a problem with Mabel's ball. That might cost her now, having to play catch-up. Both settling quickly into rhythm. You can see the contrast in styles. Mabel, heavy tail use. Happy to be alive. Everything's amazing. Olive, more steady, wasting little energy. Very much of the old Labrador school. Eating's a serious business. Don't bollocks around wagging your tail. And Mabel seems just a little sluggish here. Perhaps more was taken out of her by the worm medicine she was given last night than we thought. But Olive, focused, relentless, tasting absolutely nothing. Mabel trying, but surely a lost cause. Her title defence coming to an end. Olive taking everything. Nothing left but the ball to lick now. And Mabel, well, doesn't seem too upset. A bit of class there from the youngster, generous in what will surely be defeat, because Olive has won now. She's taken the title back at 7.5. Mabel looking to offer congratulations again to the dog who was her inspiration growing up. Once more, wonderful to see that spirit in the game. What a final we've had here. Great rivals, but great friends. Oh, and you see the swapping of balls at the end. Join us again tomorrow. Live coverage of a snooze on the sofa, possibly. Bye for now.
Jared, these animals are getting unbelievable attention right now is the one thing that kind of sticks out to me.
How many views is that at the moment? 7 million, something around that?
So, something like that. if you have any inanimate object around the house, or B, an animal, haven't done some sort of commentary on us at the moment. Are you actually in lockdown? Is what I would question. That was BBC's Andrew Cotter commentating on his two Labradors eating their food. Big fan as well of whoever the person was in the background at the start, just saying, get on with it. This is the lockdown lowdown, of course, where we've been parsing through the internet to see what's been going on. Something that's cost 136,000 views on Twitter is from Shane Welsh of Tullerone. He tweeted saying, a young lad from our club in Tullerone, hurling. He's posted this video. The only problem is, which sport will he be playing? Please let it be hurling. This is incredible. Have a look.
D-Rock, Carraford, free tackle. That's how we do it. Tom Brady. James Cavaliers. Tiger Woods. Come on.
On the table, Charlie.
Kyle Walker, Man City, the throwing king.
So poor Patrick Corgan with his squeaky voice in the middle of that. Pretty impressive stuff, but he needs to be careful. Shane Walsh acting as his agent here, giving that video away for nothing. I'd be like, here, listen, you know, where's my cut?
Yeah, I'd be worried as well for any Kilkenny. Like, it's the key to running Kilkenny hurling that you keep guys under wraps and you don't let the secret get out until they're a minor or under 21, and you know they've won a medal or two, and then they're in hurling for life. This guy now, the Kilkenny footballers could be sniffing around, the Golf Union of Ireland could be sniffing around, and like, fair play to the parents or the adults in the house for allowing a kid to take out a golf club and a ball and hit it towards the house at any point, and having to trust in him to know that it wouldn't touch the window as it went in. Unbelievable array of talents.
Yeah, but the big question is, what the hell is he doing wearing a Dublin football jersey?
This is the thing. Like, this is clearly Dublin's financial prowess.
It's like a disease.
It really
spreading
is.
Across the country, stealing our youngsters.
He's going to be Pat O'Callaghan for his jersey come the championship this year.
I don't know how you did. You get up too much at the weekend, though? Did you do anything particularly interesting, or did you achieve much with your life?
Ate a lot.
Yeah, anything? Nice. Are you one of the three or four people in the world who didn't make banana bread at the weekends?
I think I might have eaten every food under the sun that isn't called banana bread, and made every food under the sun that's not called banana bread.
It's pretty good. I recommend it. I did it on Saturday, thinking, and then turned on my social media and turned out half the world was doing exactly the same thing. Here's Michael Conlon. Mine is very good, by the way. I don't normally eat breakfast, but I'm making an exception for my own banana bread. Bake some banana bread today. I'm prepared for hibernation. That's Michael Conlon. And I think he's flying low. So one of those like, oh, balls. Shouldn't have tweeted that. But he did. Fair play to him. And Nicola Coughlin from Dairy Girls, also making banana bread this weekend. And a lot of people who then obviously were like, did exactly the same thing. The Dairy Girls seem to be having, they're definitely doing well during quarantine here. Not just the fact that everybody's watching it on Netflix, but they're legitimately funny in real life too.
Yeah, absolutely. What's the recipe for banana bread?
Oh, it's like flour, bicarbonate of soda, a bit of salt, butter and sugar, a lot of sugar, some vanilla, some mashed bananas, and obviously chocolate if you want it. Or my sister was like, oh, stick a bit of peanut butter in. I didn't. I would like to. I'll do that next time. I'll be a bit more ambitious. And then that's it. That's it. It's like it's probably because it's the easiest thing in the world to make.
I didn't understand why flour had been sold out everywhere, but I now realize why that is the case.
Yeah, because you can make your own bread. You don't have to be, you know, using a JCB to break down a supermarket to get some bread if you want it.
Mm. Yeah, there is something unbelievably comforting about bread of all sorts at the moment, and then something comforting about sweet food in general. So you're combining them both with banana bread. That's my psychological breakdown on why banana bread is so popular at the moment.
It's both bread and sweet.
Mm. Exactly.
Give me some of that sweet banana bread. Like, can everybody see that? Can everybody see just like the texture of it? It's perfect.
I can't see what you're holding up there, just for FYI to the audience this morning, but it does. It sounds good. I'm not gonna lie. Like, how does it compare with, say, just mashed banana on bread? Or how does it, like, banana bread in general?
It's moist. It's nice. It's like it gets better on day two. You know the way most bread gets stale?
Yeah, it gets better.
Ingredients soak in. And it kind of, it's like a good curry, better after 36 hours. I'm actually surprised at how well it came out, to be honest.
I think that's the first time the word moist has ever been used on OTBAM, and I need to go take a shower.
I don't know why you're so filthy. I don't know why that word has so many, I don't know why so many people have an issue with that word. It's like, you know the way some people can't look at frogs, especially the ones with holes in them. The word moist apparently seems to have a similar reaction. I want to talk about the other thing that we all did at the weekend, which was invited some 3D animals into our homes. Mm. This was it late Saturday evening. We got a WhatsApp going. We spent a lot of time today on this, and suddenly we had a tiger in our living room. We had the horse was absolutely massive. There was a hedgehog, which was perfect as well. There was a shark, which was very impressive. So if anybody doesn't know, over the course of the weekend, on most phones, I think Google released this thing where if you search for an animal, emperor penguin, for example, search for that, and then it's, oh, would you like to see one in real life? And then you press the button and 3D one appears in your living space or wherever the camera is switched onto. What did you have on? I mean, obviously, you're a grown-up and you've no kids, so you've no real excuse to be doing this, but what did you do?
No, I like created a virtual cat and just stared at it, and the cat stared at me for a good 20 minutes.
And you didn't get your mates in kind of funny situations with it? I mean, no. That's obviously what's going to happen now over the next while.
No, I entertained myself with the cat, and that was it. That's how I lead my life. There has been, like, I know the DSPCA are like increasing the opportunity for people to foster animals, and I think that they've actually got to a stage where so many people have fostered animals at this point that they're actually running out of animals, which is a great story. Obviously, I'm sure people want to log on. I'm sure there's still a few, but maybe this is a way to fill that void. If you haven't been lucky enough to foster an animal, if that's something you wanted to do, take up Google and just create a cat, create a dog, put it in your living room. I tried to look for a red panda, but they don't have red panda yet. I'm surprised they have emperor penguins.
They have giant pandas. You could have a giant panda. But I mean, if any psychologists out there want to give us a Freudian analysis of Owen spending a lot of time in his room with 3D of a cat, then I'd be happy to bring them to air. You can just get us on Twitter at Off the Ball. I want to move on quickly because this is the reason we brought this up. A listener whose name is Kieran Boyle sent this in to Golf Weekly, to Joe and Nathan. We're still able to play golf here in Florida, listening to the pod on the cart with some gators keeping me company. Big fan of the show. Keep them coming, hashtag friend of the pod. And there is like an actual alligator. The alligator is very impressive in the Google 3D, by the way. There's an actual alligator in the water there, who looks like he's a little bit close for comfort. The 3D ones are scary enough where they turn, they pivot, and they snap. That's like a real one in the water as you play golf. I'm not sure I would really like that. Have you got one last one for us, Owen?
Yeah. It's time for Belarus to shine, Jer, because the league has been attracting global attention as it plays on. So on Saturday, there were six top-flight games in Belarus, including the derby between FC Minsk and Dynamo Minsk, watched by capacity 3,000 crowd in the Belarus capital. It so happened that this derby was practically the only official football match on earth, read Dynamo's match report after their 3-2 defeat. There's been fewer than 100 cases and no deaths so far from coronavirus in Belarus, which has a population of around 9.5 million. It seems that their president isn't
really
worried. This is the thing. Your skepticism is going to ruin a good news story, Jer. There's like been a situation here where like the president has kind of suggested that citizens of the country drink vodka to combat the disease. So they're obviously taking this thing very seriously indeed. But the Belarus Football Association said they've taken all procedures to actually ensure these things can go ahead. But there you go. If you're looking for a bit of action, if you're looking to get behind a team, then perhaps FC Minsk or Dynamo Minsk is a team for you right now.
All right. Good stuff. And we'll obviously, we say it now, we're laughing, but we're going to be watching those games at some point over the next few weeks going, I like the formation there. I like what you've done with the place. The rug really brings it together. Dermot Ling is going to join us next here live on OTBAM. Here is the Sunday paper of you reacting to Michael Dighton talking about his father passing away amid the COVID-19 pandemic in the Mail on Sunday. It's Vincent Hogan and Kieran Shannon who joined Joe Malloy. Have a look.
He blends in really nicely with the man that his father was, and there's a bit of humour there as well. I think I would have heard him on some of the talk shows with you or road shows with you. Him talk before. I think you might have heard that line, Joe. I don't know if it was to yourself.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah. Was it himself and Dahi might have been on and talking about their nerves before those All-Irelands in the mid-90s. There's a good bit of humour there where, you know, he was very nervous before the 94 All-Ireland. And he was conveying to his father about how he was struggling with eating and the nerves that he was feeling. And the father said, eat up. There's no point in making a fool of yourself in Crow Park and being hungry as well, you know. So the sense of the man came across, and a sense of Michael as well. You know, the man has been through an awful lot. He wrote one of the most powerful J autobiographies in terms of about his late wife Adele. And as I said, he's someone I don't particularly know and wouldn't always agree with, but I've always admired, and all the more for that. And no, it's a piece, like we've just touched on it, but it's, in fairness, it's and fair play to him, as well as the paper, that he was given scope and he filled there. It must be a 2,500-word piece easily, and it's I'd urge people to go along and get the paper for that alone. It's a very strong, affecting piece.
Yeah, agreed. He says that his mother only had two very brief visits, which is very hard on her. When someone is that sick, normally you'd get a bit more time. And then he talked about the decision not to have anyone in the house apart from themselves, given what was going on. He said that included uncles and aunts and cousins, a hard decision, but one we felt was necessary. He writes, Vincent, about his father as well. My father worked long hours. He worked hard for his family. He handed over whatever few quid he got. He looked after all the work and things around the house. But Mum did everything outside the house, the banking, the doctor, the dentist. It might be different now, but every family had that split. They would have been 56 years married this year.
Yeah, I think what's lovely about this, Joe, is we actually get a sense of his father without knowing him, obviously. I think this will ring true for so many people in terms of Irish manhood. And the heading on the piece is, "My dad never said it to me, but he was very proud. I knew he was." And I'm reminded of when my own dad was dying in 2002, and I was basically living down in Nenagh to bring him on drives and into the regional hospital in Limerick. And I remember one day the matron in the regional hospital in Limerick said to me, "You know your dad is dying." And I said, "Yes, I do." And she said, "You should tell him you love him." And I thought long and hard about that. And I never did tell him I loved him, for the very simple reason I felt it would make him deeply uncomfortable. He wasn't that type of man. He was someone who kept his emotions in check, who left it all to my mother to do exactly the way Michael describes his mother, taking them to matches and that. But what you get from the piece, and Michael's dad, Patter, was a Galway man. And there's a lovely sense of mischief. When Michael was going to be playing against Galway in the minor All-Ireland semi-final, he describes going to Mass that morning and coming home from Mass and looking up on the roof, and his dad had a Galway flag on the chimney. And it's little things like that, though we didn't know him, and you know, obviously this was news to me. I actually was thinking about ringing Michael about something else, entirely else, different during the week, and I'm shocked to read the piece. But I think it's lovely in the sense that it conveys this kind of unspoken love between a father and a son, that as Irish men, certainly of my generation, and I suspect Michael, even though he's a bit younger, his generation too, we've always found it very difficult to communicate that love openly.
That's the pay-per-view yesterday, talking about Michael Dignan's piece, where he wrote eloquently about the passing of his father. And the last voice you heard there was Vincent Hogan. The whole thing is available for downloads on podcast. Best place to get that is the Go Loud app, or of course you can get it on offtheball.com. Dermot Ling is with us. Dermot, I don't know, good morning to you first off, and I don't know if you actually heard that there, did you?
I did. I just caught the end of it. I didn't hear the full piece.
The bit there was Vincent saying that the nurse, when he was minding his own father, as his father was telling him to tell him you love him, and it would have made his dad too uncomfortable. And it's a very Irish thing where, like, oh no, geez, you can't be telling me that now. I mean, things must be really bad.
Yeah. I don't know about that really. I think that it's probably a very common thing, definitely. Is it an excuse, and I don't mean that critically, but is it an excuse to say that would have made him uncomfortable, or would the situation be so uncomfortable for you that you mightn't say it? I don't know. I think that differs from place to place. But I do know that I suppose coming the other way down, when your father says it to you, you know, one of the things I think a son wants from their father is for them to be proud, or from their parents in general, but from the father in this case is to be proud. And when they say it to you, if they ever say it to you, it is deeply uncomfortable, and it feels like the thing that you were seeking. And then when you get it, you're like, oh, Jeannie, I didn't want that so much in the end. But then afterwards, when the situation fades away and you're left with that feeling of knowing that, I think it's something that just rests deep inside of you and is a well of something that's available to you, because, yeah, it's a good thing to know. So I wonder, does it work the other way around to tell, is that what your father wants to hear towards the end or at any stage for you to be able to say, you have to stand as a man in front of him and say that you love him? I'd imagine there's solace in it.
I wonder, Dermot, if actually we're getting to a point now where things have changed. Here we are. I mean, obviously that's 18 years ago, and in 2020, in the middle of a global pandemic, is communication, particularly among Irish males, getting to a point where we're like, actually, you know what? It's about time that we all told the truth.
Yeah, I suppose the conditions, Jar, isn't it what's most interesting at the moment? Like the conditions of where we'll even get to tell that truth. I mean, is it going to be through windows? Is it going to be on Skype calls? Did we take our opportunity when we had the chance? Is this going to highlight the fact that you don't get so many opportunities all the time? And you really have to take them when they do come. And I imagine there's a lot of people are either have already unfortunately realized that, or they're about to realize it if the numbers and the predictions are going to be accurate. So yeah, I think definitely it's so hard, isn't it? For other people, I don't know how to say it for other people, because everybody's in their own individual situation. But it does feel like that if you're sitting on it, like, and something like this comes along and sweeps normal away, and now we're facing, very realistically, we're facing a new normal. Definitely. I think it's time. Yeah, we have to, and I think we are dealing with it. Like, we definitely are dealing with it bit by bit. We're in, maybe some feel maybe we've gone too far, where young men are too soft or too flahoolock with their feelings, and that's countenanced against the stoic man, who we're also trying to kind of break down a little bit and find that middle ground. And I think that's maybe the struggle of our generation, and the younger generation at least.
I think anybody who watched your Liquid Grail recently will know that you have this beautiful setup in rural Kerry, where you're foraging for food and you're growing your own stuff. It's like the kind of perfect scenario in preparation for a situation like this.
Maybe I was preparing, Ger. Do you know one of the things that they left out, and I was just considering it last night after talking to the good Owen Sheehan there, was that in the interview it came up about Off the Ball and my time there. And one of the things that didn't make the cut was how well that I was taken care of by Off the Ball and by News Talk and by you in particular, Ger, and by Garrett Hart when it was a time of struggle. And it didn't make it in, but I definitely like to acknowledge that now. As regards the setup, I am in the middle of moving, would you believe? I had to leave this house, and I'm moving greater than 2 kilometres away, unfortunately, but we have to do it, and there's no great choice in it. So we're making a few trips back west, and we're setting up shop back there, and we'll start again pulling up the ground and starting to plant and continue preparations. And, you know, this all came for me by just kind of following deeper instincts, and I'm glad, or I feel at least, I don't feel hugely put out by this whole situation, and I don't mean that from the point of view of the effect that it's having on human health and the people around me, just my physical situation. It's not really affecting me a whole lot, because it's a little bit closer to how I live anyway. And one of the great struggles with that, and I think maybe it's a struggle that people might be facing, an awful lot of people might be facing at the moment, and if there was something I could say to that, is that I spent a few years now not really knowing where money is going to come from, and not knowing if I could make rent, or not knowing if I would have enough for different things to provide for my family and things like that. And the more that tension came up in me, I felt the more of a block that I was creating in going to find work and to enjoy whatever work that I did manage to find. And I had to really sit with that for quite a while and allow that feeling and that tension to just kind of just examine it and to let it fade away a little bit. And the more I'd bring it up to the surface and say, OK, there it is. What is it? It's that I feel that I'm not good enough, or it's that I feel that I'm not capable, or that my talents are useless, or whatever it is. And that I'm a bad partner, and I'm a bad father, or whatever. I had to like really examine those feelings and let them fall away. And I found that once I could do that, it might be a stretch for people who don't prescribe to similar beliefs that I have, maybe. But once I cleared those things out, I felt that I was paving the way, opening the way for more work to come in. And that's just generally what happened. When it was really needed, it came in, and it continued to come in. So. Preparation in terms of growing food and stuff like that are really very small things, because I see like the seed shops and the sets of spuds and onions and everything else are sold out everywhere. Everybody's gone back to growing. By following instinctual life in myself, it's led me to here, and more the great battles of it have been in sitting with that kind of stuff that people are probably going through a little bit more at the moment because of the uncertainty, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The way you described dealing with anxiety there, I think, is kind of a toolkit for everybody. It's very difficult, though, Dermot, to hold yourself up to that constant rigorous self-scrutiny. Like, you have to be nice to yourself at some point along the way, too.
Oh, yeah, Jeannie Mac, for sure, Ger. These are moments. Like, these are just individual moments that come up in a day. They don't... You're not sitting with it, like, you're not sitting in the lotus position for the entire day or anything like that, like trying to observe these things. It's just, it might be 20 minutes, it might be 10 minutes, you know, they're very short. And in your day, then you're still going about your day in you know, enjoying your kids or enjoying things that you enjoy doing. That self-scrutiny definitely becomes too much and leads to, Jeannie Mac, leads to even greater struggles without doubt. It's just observing what's there. It's not looking for things. It's not going hunting for more problems. It's like, okay, if something comes up and you hear a voice of criticism or you hear a voice of uncertainty, it's just to not to hide from it, I suppose, at least, you know, more often than you wouldn't if you weren't aware that that's a thing that happens to people.
Yeah, for sure. Dermot, the bit where you made the decision to be more instinctual in life, I think a lot of people would like to access some part of that now. Even the physical manifestation of it is that, as you say, seeds are sold out. So people are actually beginning to embrace a little bit of this. Now, maybe a lot of those seeds are going to sit in someone's back sheds and they'll rot and won't actually end up planted. You know, like the road to hell is paved with good intentions. How do people access their instinctual selves a bit more?
Well, I think that this is maybe... I think it's necessity, unfortunately, in some respects, but I think that's what the corona maybe represents. We'd continue, really, wouldn't we, on our path, even if we weren't quite sure and we weren't quite happy, we would continue on our path because we make our path kind of acceptable enough to ourselves, because we get our coffee in the morning and that feels good, and we have nice food around us and that feels good, and everything is kind of reasonably acceptable outside of maybe the fact that the work that you're doing might not be of any great necessity to the world in reality, or the work that you're doing doesn't feed that kind of those burning questions in your soul. And so for me, it just came out of necessity. The decision made me, I didn't really make that decision to live more instinctually. There was no choice. And I feel with coronavirus, maybe it's a little bit similar, that people have been forced to stay at home and have been forced to stop working and have been forced really to observe type of life. I think it was maybe Roland O'Gara was talking to him, was saying during the week about, you know, having this time now to look at what he's actually doing and see if it's something that, you know, how acceptable it is to him or how desirable it is to him. And I think a huge amount of people are in the same situation. So I think it's just responding to life. You know, life forced me down this road in a way, and I see it's the most perfect road for me. And I think a lot more people are now going to be in that situation. So just it's there's a need, I suppose. It's not how to do it, in a way, it's how not to do it. And the way not to do it is to fight it. I think that's it. We're like to resist it and say, oh, we need to get back to normal as quick as we can. It's like, just don't resist it. Like allow it to take the shape that it's going to take. And you don't know, like you might feel you're not skilled enough or not capable enough to do what you need to do. Even though your job is lost or your company has closed and you're like, well, what else can I do? Like life is just inviting you on a whole other adventure, and you will make it through because we do. And we live in a country where we look after people. And I'd say this more than ever, we really see how interconnected we are and how much compassion exists in Irish society. And I think that to maybe that fear and that uncertainty to just allow for it, but to move past it in looking forward to what new adventures in front of you. And that's easy to say, Jared, like that's very easy to say when it's going on and you're in the middle of it and there's people around you dependent on you and kids are dependent on you and stuff like that. That's that's no mean feat, but it's definitely, there's so much gold on the other side of that tension and that fear, I think. So life will lead you down that way. And I think I'm not grateful for the coronavirus arriving or anything like that, but I would say it's pushing people more maybe towards aligning themselves with what they actually want to be doing with their lives. Possibly. That's from the outside, I suppose.
Yeah, I think a little bit about what you're talking about is an opportunity here for us to re-examine what it is that binds us together. Mm-hmm. When you have somebody like Boris Johnson saying all of a sudden he actually does feel like there is a society after all, when things have turned around so much that the leader of the Tory party has now gone, actually, you know what, there is a society and we really need it. Then, you know, the world has turned on its axis quite significantly. I watched Let Go Gael last night for the first time, and there's an amazing scene at the end where you're talking about the ash dieback, and I couldn't help but be struck by the parallels of, you know, this disease which is sweeping across the world and has arrived on our shores and how we're going to deal with it. And in a weird way, it felt like there was kind of a minor preparation in terms of your brain space about this thing which is coming to us, and we have to be prepared for it, and we all have to join in together to overcome it, or we can be completely taken over by it and not be prepared for it. And I don't know if there is any kind of parallel between that, or if it was just because it was late at night on a Sunday evening and I was looking at this going, Jesus, there's something here, you know?
I think there is, Ger. And if we could use that parallel, and I was considering that last night as to how, you know, there's experts out there who know about diseases and health and proteins, which is what this COVID is. Protein, and there's people who know an awful lot more about that than I do, and so it's like, how do I make what I feel relevant to people through sport? And I could, some things came to me, but actually that's probably the most significant thing that you've mentioned, so thanks for bringing it up. And I think that when it comes to something like ash dieback, in the case of the ash tree, what we tend to do to beat the disease, the big bad ash dieback disease that come in, is like, how do we treat it? How do we kill it? How do we poison it? How do we win the war against it? And if you talk to like the mycologists, the people who are in nature, and I don't know how, they're not in a lab observing nature, the people who are really in nature, they will say that it's all about the health of the all. It's all about the biodiversity of the area. So we don't plant, we'll say, 100 ash trees. We plant 20 oak, 20 birch, 20 willow, and then 40 ash trees. And those 40 ash trees are going to be an awful lot healthier than the 100 that you would have planted, because the disease will just obliterate the 100, all of them. And I can't help but feel like this is similar for us, because looking at the statistics from Italy, I think it was something like 1% of people didn't have underlying conditions. And that points to maybe ill health. That points to maybe a weakness in our overall health. And are we going to tackle and win the war against the big bad disease? Or are we finally going to maybe start considering what is causing such levels of ill health in our society, like in relation to things like cancer, and then moving right down the line to things like depression and how much something like loneliness can affect people and our suicide rates. And so is it time? I read a lovely quote about the fish. The next time, it's not there now, but I have it there somewhere. It's a fish in a tank, and the disease has gotten the fish. And do we take out and isolate the fish, or do we clean the water in the tank? And I think we need to maybe start observing our overall societal health, and the things like the spraying of toxins on our food, and the health of the things. There's a lot of stuff that I've talked about already in the doc, but I think it's definitely inviting that if our focus was less on the war on disease and more on what is the health of our society, what is the health of our most vulnerable, are we prolonging life on drugs, or can we change the water in the tank? Can our overall conditions of health be a little bit purer, a little bit more natural? Would something like COVID have the effect that it's having? Because it's just another form, it's just another iteration of life, isn't it? With its own sentience, with its own desire for life, and it's going to morph into something else because we're going to develop the immunity ourselves to it anyway. But I think it points to maybe our overall health, even though we're living longer and we can have that metric in society of, well, that shows you that health is better. But if you look around and you see the amount of struggles that, you know, every time I go back to Wexford, I mean, cancer levels are there's 4 or 5 new cases in our little village every time I go back, you know. So I think that we've bigger questions in terms of health other than COVID. And I do think it's important to be able to hold the empathy for people like Michael, for my own grandparents and granduncles and grandaunties who I'm observing at the moment and trying to stay in contact with. I think it's also important that we observe what's happening around us and how a lockdown, how the situation in society can continue with the constant threat and constant fear of the big bad virus that's going to kill everybody. I think you can get a lot past in those times, and I think I think it's important just to remain. You just keep your eyes open to see what changes in society are happening around us, and are they going to continue? If I get the flu next year, Jar, I'm just wondering these things. You know, if I get the flu next year, should I self isolate? Because the flu kills old people. Like, this is a fact. And if I have the flu, I could kill old people. Are old people going to have to hold back from society now, hold back from children, because children are carriers of disease? Is this, you know, what is the new normal? And when those questions are up for grabs, and when we have it falls to people. It falls, and I don't think it falls to governments. I don't think it falls to organizations. It falls to people to make sure that our progress forward is one of unity and is one of physical contact that the human body, I think, needs. But for the moment, obviously, social condition or social distancing and isolation, these things are the most effective thing to flatten the curve. But we have to keep an eye on where things are going as well, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Jeremy, it's always great accessing a little bit of your wisdom. I wish you the best of luck with the move and whatever's next for you. If anybody hasn't seen The Liquor Gale, it's worth an hour of your time. And also, anybody else should dig out the recent Keith Duggan piece that Jeremy did as well. It's always brilliant talking to you, and keep well, man.
Lovely, Jared. Thanks very much. There's a lovely article there by Charles Eisenstein. I put it up on Twitter yesterday, and some of the ideas, I suppose, some of the things that I've been really feeling deep down about this are in that article on the coronavirus. It should be very easy to find. Charles Eisenstein. A lot of very, very valuable wisdom in it for us.
At Dermot Ling on Twitter. Good man, Dermot. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Jared.
We are going to take a quick break here. Hashtag OTBAM. Alan Quinlan standing by to talk to Owen next.
For me, the moment of the tournament was not in the final or the semi-final. It was in the quarter-final. It was this description of Dennis Bergkamp's goal.
Nederland gaat in de halve finale komen. Ik heb opeens zo'n gevoel dat we in de halve finale gaan komen. Met het balbezit voor Frank de Boer. Frank de Boer speelt de bal heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp neemt de bal aan! Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp! Oh! Frank de Boer speelt de bal naar Dennis Bergkamp! Die neemt de bal feilloos aan! En hij schiet de bal erin! We spelen nog officieel 20 seconden! seconden. Dennis Bergkamp, 2-1.
Lads, that is football.
That moment. We spoke about Tardelli last week, where you're lost in the emotion of a celebration because of something you've done. Tardelli wouldn't have scored as many goals as Bergkamp, whatever. Bergkamp's reaction to that goal, the pass, and then the reaction to what he'd just done, the absolute disbelief, and the fact that Bergkamp is like a guy with a fear of flying. He's a very shy individual. He has his own kind of human traits like the rest of us. If you meet him, he's not a remarkable individual. He's not going to tell you, like, oh, I was an amazing football player. He's very down to earth. But the goals he could score, and for me, that's one of the all-time best goal scorer moments. Not only was it in the 90th minute, but to take place in Marseille as well, like pretty much the home of football in France. Unforgettable stuff.
Yeah, it really was an incredible goal. Well, I had forgotten that Ortega had got himself sent off before it. That, you know, for the headbutt on Van der Sar, you know, Ortega's one of these Argentine playmakers that, like, they always tried to have someone as the next Maradona. Mm-hmm. You know, they had various sort of incarnations of it, and he had this sort of the size and the build and the number 10, and like he had these moments of brilliance, but obviously he had the you know, the self-destruct overcame the brilliance in that. But the Bergkamp goal, you played the clip there. I got a lot of comments earlier on, John, about the Barry Davies commentary on that as well. People saying it was just an amazing piece of commentary that he produced. But that was just an awesome. I remember Bergkamp scoring a great goal for Arsenal against Leicester. Do you remember that in a Premier League game point? And it was late enough in the game as well. But that moment, from basically a sort of a hopeful punt forward in the sun, I like that.
That's
is
a bit harsh, Dan. No, it was a better pass than that.
Well, it was an angled ball. It was a very angled ball, I guess. But he still, I mean, you wouldn't be talking about that pass 22 years later if it wasn't for the control. I mean, the fact he plucked it out of the air, like that's what made it so good. You know, I'm sure several similar passes were tried in the same game, but that was just.
Yeah, great stuff there from Dan McDonnell, Johnny Ward with John and Neil on Saturday's Off the Ball. They are going back through all the World Cups in recent memory. Saturday was France 1998, and you get the full piece back now on youtube.com/off the ball. Before we get into this morning's Classic Game Club, we've got time for a quick check-in with Alan Quinlan. How are you getting on, Quinny?
Fine, Owen, and yourself?
Good, thanks. What have the weekends entailed for you? Ger was saying earlier on that everybody's been cooking banana bread. What have you been getting up to?
Just trying to get out cycling, go for walks and stuff like that. I think doing some sort of exercises helps me. I think the days are pretty long, and my son is keeps asking me what time it is and what we're doing today. And sometimes I'm bored. It comes up a lot. So really just trying to get out and keep moving. Both of us are on the bikes, and we cycle down to the park and move around as much as we can. I think obviously you've got to be more careful now with the new restrictions, but I certainly find it's no different than anyone else. I think everybody's finding it challenging, and I think for me is trying to get out in a bit of nature and keep moving is helpful.
Just looking at your social media, Alan, over the course of the weekend, you were digging out some old photos, I think.
Yeah, I suppose I was just looking through some photos, and I'm not normally somebody who goes back looking at photos or results or looking at medals and stuff. And I just found a great photo of Mick Galway, John Langford, John Hayes, myself and Anthony Foley. When John, I actually got it wrong on Twitter when I initially saw it. I thought we were in Kilkenny, because we spent lots of time down in Kilkenny, particularly when we were playing for Shannon. We would stay, maybe if we played in Dublin, we would travel back to Kilkenny on the Saturday night. John Hayes, myself, maybe Anthony, and have a night over in Mick Galway's. And so I thought that was one of the many times we were in Galway's house in Kilkenny, but it was actually, in fact, in Capamore in John's house when his first daughter was born, Sally. So it was obviously, it just brings back kind of happy memories of our time together with Shannon. And it just made me realize how lucky we were with the players we had there. You know, I think I put up another picture of the 98 final when Axel was captain, and it was myself, Golov and Axel who were in that particular photo. Somebody sent it on to me, and a copy of that picture, and that was a pretty famous day for the All-Ireland League and for Shannon There was over 20,000 people in Lansdowne Road for that final in 98. So they were. I was getting a bit nostalgic and looking back, and they brought back happy memories. And I was thinking the impact John Langford made with Munster and with Shannon, and how lucky I was to play with all those players. And when I joined Shannon in probably 93, 94, under 20s, and then went on to play on the senior team. And just that photo brought back some of those memories, and it was really nice to see it.
It's a great time to be nostalgic, actually. It's a great opportunity to actually reflect a little bit, just go through old photos. Like, I presume the time with Shannon and that photo with Golov and Axel is fantastic. I presume that goes down as one of the happiest moments you had in your playing career, that Shannon era.
Yeah, well, I counted myself very, very lucky, and without sounding any bit disrespectful to the other clubs in Limerick, when I played, being from Tipperary, and I played on the Ireland under-18s team and captained them, a lot of the clubs in Limerick were trying to sign me from Clanwilliam, and it wasn't that there was money involved or anything like that. It was really they were trying to turn my head to go and join a club in Limerick. I wanted to probably stay with Clanwilliam for as long as I could, and keep playing with the team there and try and give as much back as I could, because I did realise, without being cocky, I did realise that, look, when I left, I probably wouldn't be back for a long time, and I was confident that I could go on and play senior rugby in Limerick, and my hope and thoughts were to try and go on and play for Munster in Ireland, obviously. So Young Munsters tried to sign me, Gary Owen tried to sign me, Shannon tried to sign me, so my head was being turned by all the clubs, and I loved the fact that I would have went to many games with my dad when I was younger into Limerick to see All-Ireland League games on Saturday between the Derby matches, which were incredible, and Gary Owen and Shannon Young Munsters, and so I would have had a real interest in the All-Ireland League and the way it was going since it came in to fruition, and I wanted to play there, so I chose Shannon mainly because of Mick Galway, really, and we got to know each other. I was working in a garage in Tipperary town, and he used to collect me for training. But it was a very rewarding decision, because when I started playing for Shannon first under 20s, I played in a brilliant under 20s side that won the Munster League, the Limerick League, and the Limerick Cup. We won the three trophies that were available to us. Axel was our captain. We had many brilliant players in that team, and it was just incredibly enjoyable. And I in those early years, when I was probably 19, 20, I would play probably three games a weekend, two on Saturday, one on Sunday, because I would always try and go back and play with my club, Clanwilliam, on Sunday. So it was crazy to think that you played three games, and then I was playing under 20s for Munster and senior games for Shannon in the afternoon on Saturdays. But it was a decision that was very rewarding, and it gave me an opportunity to kind of start training with Munster pretty much straight away. And once I started playing in the senior team with Shannon in 95, I was training with Munster a couple of months later and made my debut for Munster in 96. But the success we had with Shannon was just incredible. I look back in the team that started that 98 final in Lansdowne Road, where there was close to 25,000 people. And I really remember the excitement that the build-up to that game between two Limerick teams, massive rivals, going to Dublin, playing in Lansdowne Road for the All-Ireland League final. And, you know, Marcus Horan was at our loose head, Mark McDermott, John Hayes, Mick Galway, Kevin Keane, Eddie Halvey, Anthony Foley, and myself for the forward pack. Seven of us were playing for Munster. Kevin Keane was the exception that time. So I was very lucky that I went into a side that was, on the up, really. They won the league in 94, 95, the senior team. I didn't play in that year, but I won three All-Ireland Leagues then in that famous four in a row run. And they were special times, because people are so passionate about the rugby, and the club game was so strong back then in Limerick, and it was just incredible to be part of it, and it certainly helped me in my development and in going on and getting the opportunities I did with Munster and with Ireland.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people over the last couple of weeks or so, Alan, have obviously been forced into communicating quite a bit over phone or via Zoom or Skype or whatever kind of software they're using. And I think it's actually led to a little bit better communication in some parties. Like, I'm not sure when it comes to someone like Mick Galway, is he someone that you picked up the phone to over the last couple of weeks to see how he's getting on? Are you communicating in a way that you wouldn't ordinarily do?
No, I'd always speak to Mick every couple of weeks, and if it went too long, it wouldn't be any longer than 2 weeks anyway, so there'd be WhatsApp messages or texts, and we're not ringing each other going back over all days. It's just really checking in with each other. And I've spoken to John Langford in Australia as well, and they're starting to experience a different sort of scenario with COVID-19 as well, and it's getting pretty serious there too as regards their restrictions. So I'd speak to Rog in France, I'd speak to Mike Prendergast. Really, I probably speak to, you know, you are speaking to people a little bit more, but none of us as sports people, former sports people, are going back talking about old games. Although I did speak to Rog on Saturday, and he was I asked him would he say this, not me, but he was watching back in some Munster games, particularly in 98, and he was telling me how good I was and how influential I was in many of the tries that Munster scored. He said you were very underestimated at times, and it just made me realise how important you were. And I was there, will you do me a favour? Will you go on Off the Ball on Monday and tell the world about this? Because give me a bit of an ego boost and make me feel better in myself. Because I was saying, yeah, well, look, you got all the glory to kind of stand up and have the shiny Adidas boots on you and getting paid to wear them and take the shots at goal and finish off the work that the forwards were doing. But I didn't really get credit at times, but look, I didn't want it. It's always nice to hear people saying good things about you, but I think it was funny just when he was saying that to me on Saturday. But yeah, I would chat to lots of the boys, but not really recounting old games.
But was Ronan a hard man to please as a teammate?
He was pretty hard to please because he was just so demanding, and I think he demanded high standards of himself and everyone around. And he was narky, he was fiery. We were always very close, but and that probably led to him being us having lots of little scraps and scrapes and verbal scrapes, because I could never catch him. He'd always run away if I tried to grab hold of him if he accused me in training. But I remember coming back from an injury one time. We were actually training in Gary Owen. I think there was something being done to the pitch in Thomond Park, and he more or less told me I was, I was on the second team, if you like, and running against the starters for the weekend. I was just coming back from injury, and I was just being my usual myself, trying to mess up the opposition and frustrate them and stop their lovely free-flowing team run for the weekend. And we had a little scrap, and he told me I am where I am because I'm such a useless F-U-C-K-E-R, and kind of ran away and more or less said, you know, I deserve to be over here now. And but he pretty much he apologized pretty much straight afterwards again. But I actually didn't react to that one because it was actually just it was quite funny at the time. But Roger was loads of us had little scrapes and scraps, and that's just part and parcel. Every team does. I'm sure Leinster had it, Connacht, Ulster as well at times, and the competitive nature of it. But Roger was fiery, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I'd imagine he was. Listen, Alan, great chatting to you this morning. We'll chat to you again on Friday morning, I'm sure.
Thanks, all. Cheers.
Alan Quinlan there on the line. We are back with the Classic Game Club. We're looking back at the 1998 All-Ireland Football Final between Kildare and Galway. Before that, quick break.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Okay, you are very welcome along to the Classic Game Club here on OTB AM. It's the show where we go back and watch old matches that are available in full on the internet. And thanks to Official GEA on YouTube uploading a particularly interesting match. Well, interesting or not interesting, I think we'll get to that in a while. We are thankful that we were able to go back and watch the 1998 All-Ireland Final between Galway and Kildare. We've got Ger and Tommy here. Tommy, this was your suggestion a couple of weeks ago before Official GEA put this up, so your prayers have been answered.
Yeah, thankfully. To be honest, we're going to get to a little later the quality of the game itself, how good it really was. I think that...
Let's get to it now.
You obviously thought it was a lot better.
Greatest game of all time, according to one noted scribe.
Third greatest All-Ireland final.
Now, look, the third greatest All-Ireland final of all time, or was it the last 20 years?
All time.
That's how Martin Brahney described it. I think it was actually a really, really good game. I think it was a really good game. But I have a feeling that the fact that I've watched The Year Till Sunday 8 times, perhaps, tinted the fact that I thought it was way better than it was. But still, it was such a good game. There's moments of individual madness. Never mind brilliance. It's class.
Joe, were you at this?
I don't agree, no.
I didn't realise, Tommy, that this was your suggestion, because I was going to wreak a revenge on Owen that would never stop for forcing me to go through this in the middle of a global pandemic. And I'm doing this, as you can see, with the... So we're recording this on Sunday evening. So if anybody wonders about me problem drinking on Monday morning, we've actually recorded this on Sunday evening. I just wanted to make that clear. And I am going to be having a glass of wine in the middle of this, because this is the first time I've seen this game since 1998. I was at the game. I was reporting for FM 104. And... I was at every game that year. I covered the whole thing, and like at that stage, that's back in the glory days of journalism, where you could walk into dressing rooms after matches. And I had been at every Kildare match, and I'd been in the change room after every game, and I'd been at some of the training sessions and the build up to it. And like, it's very hard for me to put this in any other context than to explain that in the 1990s, Kildare were Mayo are now. They were the Mayo of that decade. At the start of the decade, Mikko had arrived, and everybody had assumed that he would bring glory with him. They reached a league final in his first season, and then they crapped out against Loud in the first round. And then he left, and Dermot Early came in, and then he came back, and this is his second flowering. And in 1997, they had run Meath, who were then the All-Ireland champions, to a trilogy of matches before losing in the first round or the second round of the Leinster Championship that year. And so there was no back door. So that. I actually, in retrospect now, having watched that game today, think the 97 team was slightly better than the 98 team, particularly the 98 team that takes the field in the final because of the injuries that some key players had. And like that's the smell of want of the Kildare supporter base was the same smell of want that you have of the Mayo fans for the last decades.
Well, it's surely a bigger spell of want, is it not? Like, I mean, it's, first of all, a bigger...
I mean, yes.
The Mayo drought in 2 years... next year, in 2021, will be the exact drought that Kildare were going through in 1998. 70 years.
Wow, really?
You're a millennial, though, and you understand the OG concepts. Kildare were the OG of this whole smell of want thing and famines, and they kind of created the whole idea for Mayo to saunter in center stage and take that whole kind of it'd be great to see them do it. The thing that haunts me to this day is after the semi-final, everybody assumed that Kildare were going to win because we beat Kerry. We beat Dublin, we beat Meath, the previous three All-Ireland winners on the route to the final, and Galway had scraped through one of the worst games that had been played all year in the All-Ireland semi-final. And on the day of the game, I remember like taking my seat and some woman going, "Oh, Soss is playing, is he? I'm delighted for him, he's going to get his medal." Some old woman kind of there. And I was like, the game hasn't started. Like, what are you talking about? This Galway are really good. 2-1 on Kildare, 2-1 on.
2-1. The fact that Soss started that game, that was through an injury crisis all that week, was it? Do you remember that?
Yeah. There was a bunch of injuries.
I think Mikko really mishandled that though, dropping him that day. We might get to it a little later, but there's a good article on how he had been the worst few minutes he played all year, been in the semi final against Kerry. Then he got told by Mikko and the selectors that he was dropped. The team got named. I think on the field in Naas. That's how we found out. And Mikko said he didn't have time to ring him in advance and let him know that he was dropping him for the All-Ireland final. And then on the day of it, there's a number of injuries. There's four or five changes and he ends up getting drafted in. And he ends up man-marking Michael Donnellan for the first 15 minutes that day.
Yeah. And that's,
he did get moved fairly quickly. But look, looking back on it, it is car crash. You can see you're literally driving towards the oncoming traffic, and that's not the light at the end of the tunnel. It's an oncoming train. And that oncoming train is the pace of the various players that that Galway have, and it's just the fact that Kildare's defence in the first half is reasonable, but it's just actually quite fluky in many instances that gets them out of jail, and ultimately it's the buzzsaw in the second half.
Yeah. Can I ask a question, Ger?
Yeah, go for it.
Sorry, Owen. The smell of want that hasn't endured throughout Mayo football for all these years, like, it's still there. It still resonates so strongly, even if they aren't, say, in the top three of Owen's power rankings. What happened to Kildare's want after 1998? Did it just evaporate?
It came back. It came back when Geezer got them to the All-Ireland semi-final, and they got, Marty Clark was brilliant that day, but also some fairly horrific refereeing decisions went against them. And then Jim McGuinness, I can't even remember which comes first. McGuinness is the year after.
Yeah, Cassidy, 2011.
And since then, it just, they have had a load of nice athletes, but there's been, so that team that you saw in 98 was a team of men, and the team under McGeaney had several men in it, probably was short one or two absolute bastards that it needed to get over the line. Mm. But look, everybody says it, Kildare are too nice, you know, yeah, everybody be happy to bring in those lads home to meet the parents. Whereas actually that's not what you want. Like,
that team in 98,
a team of killers.
That team in 98 had a couple of killers.
Yeah, it had men in it. From the goalkeeper to the corner forwards. Well, one of the corner forwards anyway. They were hard ass. Looking back on it, Brian Murphy comes off the bench and can win his own ball in the full forward line, and you're thinking, ah, lads, that's what it's like when the ball doesn't come back like a table tennis. Stick a big man up in the full forward line, he's going to win his own ball. And anyway, a really interesting couple of years for Kildare football. Like, really brilliant to be an eyewitness to. And because I was too young when Mick Gorey first in 1990 to fully appreciate what was going on. But that summer, after every match in Dublin, I would go home to a tie and the pubs were lit. Like, it was unbelievable. Everybody was, you know, you'd be in a pub and normally if somebody spilled a drink in that pub on somebody else, there'd be a row outside the Chippers. At that point, people were spilling drinks over each other and it was grand. It was like, that's quite a sea change. But, you know, I don't know. They need to get back there. They, like, you kind of look at this going, we have not experienced anything like this as a football culture in a decade now. And it's very sad.
So Mick arrives in 1990. Was that the year that Tompkins and Fahey went to Cork?
No, they'd already gone, sure. They won a couple of All-Irelands in the football by that stage. And 1990 is the year that they do the double. So was it 90 or 91 was his first season? I can't honestly, now you put me on the spot, Tommy. Go to my head, I'd say 91, but I could be wrong about that. But he was there for 3 or 4 years, didn't quite make the breakthrough, but certainly raised standards, fell out with the county board. And Dermot Early Sr. stepped in for either 1 year or 2 years. And that team was still really good. But again, just couldn't get it done. And then Mickle came back in 97. They had that great season. 98 had a great season. 99, they collapsed. And then 2000, they win another Leinster. And ultimately meet Galway again in an All-Ireland semi. Just did nothing in that semi, as far as I can remember. Like, it wasn't a close game at all. It was kind of like the second half more than the first.
Mm. Just to give the full context on 98 then and Kildare's path to the final, as I've mentioned, 70 years since their last All-Ireland at this stage. They hadn't been in a final since 1935. So even just the idea of being there in the big day, there was a long old famine for that. So they had that back. As Gerard said, beaten three of the last All-Ireland winners, Dublin in the Leinster quarter-final, Leash in the semi-final, Meath then in the Leinster final, and then that All-Ireland semi-final against Kerry where Mickle takes down Paddy. So this is Mickle's 21st and last ever All-Ireland final as a manager. Kevin Walsh, in A Year Till Sunday, said that the Kerry results had Kildare as strong favourites, and it's not some sort of pie in the sky trying to play down their chances. As you said already about the odds, I think they were actually 9-4, while Galway were 9-4, obviously. Kildare were back down to 9-4 at this point. You might just get into a bit of Galway context, because it's very interesting. Obviously, like, they hadn't been in an All-Ireland final since 1983. They'd only won Connacht once in the previous 10 years, and they've obviously just turned to Mayo man John O'Mahony in the autumn of 1997 to get them over the line in 98, hoping to win their first All-Ireland in 32 years. The last team to win an All-Ireland in Galway, obviously, that great 3-in-a-row team in the 1960s. And we can have a listen to a little bit of A Year Till Sunday. First of all, you can hear the voice of Michael Donnellan, which not a lot of people tend to hear. But here he is talking about the weight of history on this Galway team.
My father won All-Ireland in 1964 and he was captain. My grandfather in 1925 won All-Ireland with Galway. You're always reminded of it. Will you ever be like the father? Will you ever be like the grandfather? Things like that.
Michael Donnellan there in A Year Till Sunday. The it's kind of
that's
mad.
Great. That clip is just fantastic.
You're not going to be good enough, young fella, unless you had that All-Ireland medal in your back pocket.
I think this matters. I actually think this really matters a lot. Like, I think that, you know, I was thinking about the greatest managers of all time. And at some point, Ger Canning in it says, Mikko, this would have been the sweetest one of them all if he could have pulled it off. And, like, it would have. Like, the achievement that he had with Kerry was unparalleled, right? An absolutely sensational achievement and innings. But to do it in a culture that has been a culture that has experienced nothing but defeat for seven successive decades is completely different from doing it in a culture where, like, at least in Michael Donnellan's family, there is a sense of, you know, you can do it. It's actually, it's an achievable thing. Like, when Kildare won the under 20 title 2 years ago, that was their first national title since the 70s at any grade. No minor All-Ireland, no under 21, no under 20. Jeez, I don't even know if they've won a club All-Ireland. Maybe they have, but I'm not sure that they have. So, like, Michael Donnellan in that game is a 21-year-old buck, and there's five of the under-21s on that team from the Galway team that year. And just having, at least in the culture, the fact they have won an All-Ireland before, I think it really matters in an All-Ireland final. Like there was a nervousness around both sides, but the nervousness kind of gave way in Galway's in the Galway team to actually, you know what, we're living here and we're still alive. Whereas the nervousness kind of burned out the energy in Kildare, I felt, in this game. And I don't know, so Mayo haven't been able to get over the line. Kildare haven't been able to get over the line. Tyrone, that's why I so value Tyrone's achievement in getting over the line. And even Armagh's, like Armagh, to a lesser extent, in that they only managed to do it once, despite the fact that they were probably just as good as that Tyrone team. This stuff, having a culture of people who have actually been in All-Ireland finals and lost them or won them, it really matters.
Hmm. It's interesting, actually, you mentioned Tyrone. This is the very day that Tyrone actually win that minor All-Ireland, 1998, the one that obviously a swathe of players come through and actually win it. So maybe that's part of it as well, that they actually have that national title in 98 to actually want to win a senior one. But I do accept it is special that they hadn't won one at all and they managed to do it. And maybe, to be honest, Armagh was actually a pretty big impact on that. Maybe it was the teams in the early 90s from Ulster that were winning All-Irelands that had a big impact on Armagh to say that, you know, Ulster can come as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting. Just to go through Galway's route to the final then. They come up against Mayo in Castlebar in the first round in Connacht. Like, I mean, the stakes during these non-qualifier era, during the non-qualifier era of football, is just incredible. Like, so Mayo, obviously, coming off the back of the last two consecutive All-Ireland finals, having lost them, they have to go to Castlebar to try and beat Mayo to keep their season alive. They do that, they beat them, then they get through Leitrim in the Connacht semi-final. Then Roscommon almost knocked them out in the Connacht final. That goes to a replay, and Galway eventually beat them. And then it's Derry then in the All-Ireland semi-final. Just going to play a couple of John O'Mahony clips from A Year Till Sunday. It's interesting in one of the scenes where O'Mahony is talking about the national perception of Galway. Here he is holding up a newspaper, proper dressing room wall stuff, talking about what the national media have been saying about Galway.
You read this after the last day. These are the people that Galway fancy gangs get the simple things wrong. I'm not a Galway man, but I have an awful loyalty to this group, and I would be hurt by that kind of a situation, by what's been said. A nice team. Don't have midfield pairing capable of winning a majority of team possession. Missing frees, all those kind of things. There's only one fucking answer for that.
Right.
Yeah, it's because we've got so few actual inside the dressing room accounts pre big games in the GA. This is before the replay against Roscommon, by the way. We don't know how common this is, but it kind of seems so out of character for John O'Mahony to be holding this up and saying we're going to effing show them on Sunday.
Nice team.
That stuff makes a difference, lads. It absolutely makes a difference. I don't know whether the Dublin team of the last 7 years have managed to block out the media or if that's just a myth that they've blocked it out, but all that stuff matters. The papers, the headlines. Like, I don't know. Like, I think that's just a brilliant clip. But, like, it definitely still happens today.
Yeah, probably does. There's then just one final thing before we kind of get into the game, one final clip I want to play anyway, is another bit from John O'Mahony. Here's what he's saying about the tactics and how he wants his Galway team to approach this game. And here are some of his thoughts on Kildare before the All-Ireland.
What that does is prevents them from getting this blanket defence that they're notorious for this year, and it also gives us an opportunity to expose the weakness in their lack of pace from getting onto the ball quickly. Okay, so the roles there are clearly defined. On the midfield, I just come to the midfield for a second. So the challenge for you is to make sure that at no stage during the 70 minutes that McCreary isn't drifting away. All right. The one thing we don't want is that there's two white jerseys jumping for it and you boys looking at each other.
Blanket defence, Kildare, Mick O'Dwyer, ruining football, Ger.
I look, again, to go back to something that I've talked about again and again about Kildare and how they've lost their way in recent years, is what is their cultural identity? What do they stand for? And watching this game, it was like really athletic, very strong, great fielders, a short passing game in defence to make sure that you found space and then get it forward really quickly. Like that's the type of identity that everybody could get behind. And their defence was sensational. There was one point where I think Neil Finnegan had the ball in the right corner forward situation, and the camera, whatever the angle was, reminded me exactly of that famous picture of Diego Maradona on the wall of Belgians that he faced in the World Cup in 86, where it turned out the ball had been broken off from a free kick. But anyway, it was like this amazing, iconic photograph of Maradona facing a wall of the opposition. And they were brilliant at that in the first half. And actually, the defence did okay. If they hadn't kept kicking wise and kicking the ball into the goalkeeper's hands, they held the Galway team to enough... a few enough scores to win that match.
Galway had an exceptional period at the start of the second half where Jaff Allen kicked those 2 points, Finnegan kicked 2 points, and Joyce got the goal. And that was the winner of the game, really, luck. I agree with you.
Galway, over that
the Kildare defence had been doing very well up to that. But when you talk about Kildare's style of football, like, and you mentioned earlier on that, was it Murphy to come off the bench and he hits the post later on, the big full forward?
Yeah. Meath, man.
I don't understand why.
No, Corkman. Corkman scored a goal against Meath in the Leinster final. That's what I'm mistaken.
I wonder if that a sliding doors moment, as you said earlier on, because they did play a Route 1 style of football. They got about 4 or 5 half goal chances off long lump balls into the square that Dermot Early was, you know, like Dermot Early wasn't a full forward. Like he was a midfielder or a wing forward midfielder. Like he wasn't a full forward. Would Murphy have made a massive difference if he had started the game in full forward? Would he have lasted?
If you know, obviously one of their tactics was to boot the ball forward. Martin Lynch didn't really get any change from who he was up against, and Craig was essentially there to take frees, and so he's the first one to come off, and because they didn't actually win any frees, and as soon as he gets subbed off they actually get a scorable, kickable free that might have got him into the game a little bit earlier on. But if you'd had Murphy up there like fighting with people because he was a man, then I think it would have made a significant difference. The ball would have stuck in the full forward line, but every time the ball got lorried up to them, it was coming straight back. And, you know, Galway have pace everywhere and were able to use that pace, and they were very smart about it. But I actually don't think it is a sliding doors moment. I was very surprised because, again, I haven't seen that game since then. But, like, so the Kildare of 1990, what I do remember is them being accused of playing basketball, pardon me, and that they, you know, they were being accused of ruining the game because they were hand-passing the ball too much. I actually expected them to be a team that hand-passed the ball way more. Certainly my memory of the team at that stage was that they were a team who passed the ball, hand-passed the ball way more than this team did. And I was surprised to see so much ball being kicked forward. But like, I think that's what our style should be. Mm. Like, I think that's what our county's identity should be. They should get the tape from this game and go, you do everything except when you're in a scoring position, you give it to one of your anointed kickers and you don't try those Hail Mary shots from where you can't score from. And I'm looking at you, defenders and half-forwards.
Well, I could definitely see Kevin Feely and Tommy Mulick replacing Buckley and McCreary in midfield. And I could absolutely see Daniel Flynn being the man on the end of the square with Paddy Brophy hanging around him. And perhaps Jimmy Hyland, if he gets better. Like, that could be, there you go, that could be it. That's the trick that could be missing.
I think
so. Who should Murphy have started in front of? Is it Carroll Dwyer?
No, he should have started in front of Paul Craven, and they should have decided that somebody else is going to take the freeze.
Is that not a bit revision?
Or maybe you keep Martin Lynch in reserve.
Is that not like very much a hindsight call? Wasn't Craven brilliant in the All-Ireland semi-final? Obviously, he was terrible in this game. He had a very bad day things did not go his way.
He was a free taker. He was like so this is the last era where you're allowed to have a free taker in your team, as opposed to somebody whose job it is to tackle or win ball. And the way that Kildare were playing, they couldn't afford to have, like, so I don't know. I honestly, Tommy, I don't know. Like, did he come off the bench in the Leinster final against me and scored the goal that won it, or did he start that game? I can't remember.
It's just that they lumped so much ball in on early, like, they just kept lumping it in. And they didn't get goal chances, like. Yeah, they got chances. They got a lot of chances, yeah.
Well, in the very first, the second or third minute of the game, Dermot Early catches a ball, shovels, and Ray Silk slides off into the distance. And he's actually through one-on-one, but it's his, like, first possession of the game. And he snatches a shot and it goes wide. But if he'd brought that on, if he brought that on, it was a goal chance.
Yeah, McNamara made a good save off Lynch, yeah.
It's funny, Tommy, you talk about bad wides. I remember somebody saying, oh, all wides are bad. But it's not somebody who was from Kildare, because there's a difference between good wides and bad wides. And Kildare had many bad wides. And that's the other part of the DNA here that Mayo share, where forwards snatch at chances that seem straightforward and defenders come up and decide they're going to try Hail Mary, and you're like, please, can we just give it to somebody who can just kick it over on a fairly regular basis, or can we find a couple of those players whose job it is to, like, be the one who's kicking it? And maybe that's what they should use Padraig Craven for, I don't know. Like, so his job was not to win ball, but they were certainly kicking the ball into him to try and win it.
I wonder about that. Like, I kind of found myself watching this game and thinking that it felt like a really, really, really good club championship final. That's what it felt like. And I don't know whether that's because we're watching such levels of exceptional decision-making nowadays, that, you know, the standards that are there with Dublin, 75% in an All-Ireland final, or Kerry shooting accuracy. But it just felt like there was just decisions being made and shots being taken that you get hooked nowadays for doing that in a club game.
Including some that actually went over. Jaff Allen in particular would have got hooked for all the points he kicked in this final. They were all amazing.
You couldn't hook Jaff Allen.
He scored
at half time, maybe. His first half, he was like that. Second half, I actually think that second half performance of Jaff Allen is one of the greatest 35 minutes of individual sport I've ever borne witness to. Jaff Allen looked at Kildare and with his bare hands ripped their heart out and feasted on it in front of their children. He was the one who killed us. And I remember on the day going, you can't see it from the TV pictures, but like shoulders slumped as Fallon hit one first from the left-hand side and then from the right-hand side. The line ball, like Glenn Ryan thinks he's got some safety here. It's the right thing to do. Just get a touch on it. It's out for a line ball. Jaff Fallon in his Puma Kings, which I think looked yellow. I've never seen yellow Puma Kings, and I've never seen them before since. Sunshine. And he just kicks it over and it's over the black spot from the touchline. This wasn't regular. There weren't that many lads who were kicking the ball over from the touchline in the 90s. Like, no. There just weren't. It didn't happen that often. Morris Fitz, obviously. Like, yeah, but we remember Morris Fitz.
Well, exactly. That's actually that's what I thought when we saw Jaff Allen. It's like in consecutive All Ireland finals, you have two incredible sideline scores, and one of them is far more remembered than the other. I think that Jaff Allen is a fairly unheralded part of the history of Galway. I know people who think Galway will always hold him up, but I think he's actually, I did not know he was this good in this final. I just want to go through the teams before we get into a couple of the moments of the match.
We're supposed to get started. We can get started now. Yeah.
Yeah, let's start. You're very welcome, everybody.
Hit record there on.
I think it's just important to go through the teams on paper here, because, like, I love this Galway team. I think it's, I don't want to call it the hipster team of the last 22 years, but I think it is. I don't think any team that's ever come after this.
This is so depressing, by the way. There's a global pandemic on, and you made me sit through this again today for the first time in 22 years. This is the worst it's been. This is my lowest. This is the nadir of this entire last 2 weeks.
So Galway, managed by John O'Mahony, they had Martin McNamara in goal, Tomás Meehan, Gary Fahey and Tomás Mannion, their full back line. What a half back line. Ray Silk, John Dively, Sean Ogdenpuir. In midfield, you had Kevin Walsh and Sean O'Donnell. You had Michael Donnellan, Jaff Allen and Shea Walsh at the half forward line. Derek Savage, Pádraig Joyce and Neil Finnegan, the full forward line. Quality all over.
Can I just make one point? Shea Walsh, I had no recollection of Shea Walsh before or after this game, but there was just a little bit of skill in the middle of it where he dribbled around five or six of them and it ends up like they get a 45 off it because the umpire didn't imagine something. But it was amazing. He didn't touch it. Absolutely didn't touch it. But anyway, they missed 45, so justice was served. But I had no recollection of him as a footballer, and he was brilliant. Really, like that kind of jinky. You can see how over the course of a season he doesn't maybe end up having that much of an impact. But in all Ireland final, he came up big in a couple of moments.
I think he's the one changed from the semi final, isn't he? Like that's a scene in the Year Till Sunday where they're telling the team for the final, and everybody congratulates Shea Walsh on actually being the man who gets the call up. The Kildare team then managed by Mick O'Dwyer, goalkeeper Christy Byrne, a full back line of Brian Lacey, Davy Dalton, Ken Doyle, Anthony Rainbow, Glenn Ryan.
Davy Dalton didn't start. Soss comes in instead of him. Davy.
Wikipedia.
Davy is like a. You can see him. He's there in a hoodie at the end, but like he looks about 60. Honestly, like he was in the very latter stages of his career, but would have been a spiritual leader for them. Now, whether or not he would have had the pace for any of that team, I'm not sure, but he certainly would have clattered a few lads, and his reading of the game might have got him out of situations. So look, who knows? Go on, sorry. Halfback line.
Yeah, no, my apologies. I think the rest of this is correct. The halfback line, Anthony Rainbow, Glenn Ryan and John Finn. You'd Niall Buckley and Willie McCreary in midfield. You'd Eddie McCormack, Declan Kerrigan and Dermot Early. Wearing the half-forward jerseys anyway. I think Dermot Early was everything from a midfielder to a full-forward during this game. And you need Martin Lynch, Carl O'Dwyer and Padraig Craven in the full-forward line. So just on like some of these injuries, like there's a lot of folklore about rumours in the build-up to games when it comes to All-Ireland, but I think Kildare is probably a level above. So Ronan Quinn definitely out through injury. Niall Buckley hadn't been fit enough to train properly for weeks. Anthony Rainbow and Brian Lacey had hamstring niggles. Glenn Ryan pulled a thigh muscle while playing golf 2 days before the final. And then you'd hear in commentary from Gerard Canning that Willie McCreary, assistant trainer to Aidan O'Brien at the time, was rumoured to have been hit by a horse during the week, but he had played down those rumours. Apparently that wasn't true. Mikko, in his book in 2000, said, "When I saw the way things were going in the last few days before the match, I knew our luck had run out and that barring a miracle, we couldn't win. We should never have played Buckley. He was clearly unfit, but we gambled on his fitness and made a serious mistake. While it was, of course, a joint decision by the four selectors, I must accept most of the responsibility. I had been faced with a similar situation in the 1976 All-Ireland final against Dublin when we took a chance on the fitness of Jimmy Deanahan and Gerard O'Keefe with disastrous results." You blame Mikko.
It was kind of heartbreaking to see. Like, Niall Buckley's my favourite footballer, and he just didn't do himself justice in the final. There's a nice point at the end of the game where you kind of see that's exactly what it should have been like. And this should have been his time to bestride Kildare history like a colossus, and like the colossus that he was. And I would say, up until that point, Brian Lacey had been in with a shout for Footballer of the Year because he'd nullified everybody's best forwards in the previous rounds. I think he'd gone directly up against Morris Fitz, who obviously was coming off the back of the final the previous year. And so in everybody's sense that when Morris Fitz gets to Croke Park in the All-Ireland semi-final, he's going to do untold damage. And Glenn Ryan clearly also wasn't fit. Like, if these guys were fit, who knows what would have happened? But look, I obviously I'm completely and utterly one-eyed when it comes to looking at this game for the first time again. It's hard not to acknowledge that Galway team, I can see why they are the hipsters team of the last 2.5 decades, because I didn't remember that the Donlan run happened so early in the game.
Yeah,
like in my head, it's kind of part of that second half. I was like, hang on a second, look where he is. I recognize this. But those injuries, they definitely did not help.
I'm starting to really understand this connection with Mayo football and Kildare football. Excuses.
It's just not enough strength and depth.
Point taking ability.
That was a great moment with Canning on commentary. Like, Willie McCreary, horse of a man, involved with horses his whole life, rumoured to be hit by a horse in the build up to the final.
Okay, moments of the match. Jerry, you mentioned Michael Donlan, solo run. The wine is being consumed because it is the only way to do this. This is not only the moment of the match. This is the moment of all time, according to the public of Ireland, when it was voted the number one moment in 2005. Now, I remember this crystal clear. This happened in 2005, but I remember it like yesterday, sitting in my living room as a kid, watching this event on a Saturday night that RTÉ had put on. Morris Fitz's sideline point against Dublin coming in number two, getting beaten by Michael Donnellan's solo run. But there was this big, massive banquet on in Galway on the night where RTE were broadcasting from. And everybody was obviously just texting in their vote that night. It was a movement that happened in Galway to ensure this would become the number one moment of all time.
Yeah, it was like Ronnie O'Brien, who was on Juventus' books at one point, becoming Times Man of the Millennium. It was like I think David O'Doherty was behind that campaign. It's a great moment. It's certainly an important moment in the game. I'm not even sure it was Michael Donnan's greatest moment in the game. It was a beautiful point.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, it was great. I mean, is it my moment of the game? It's actually not my moment of the game. There was a bit in the second half where Declan Carrigan kicked a beautiful, one of those perfect balls that you can come and attack a diagonal, like from the middle of the pitch, which is actually hard to do, but he sweeps his foot across it and it kind of swerves around and it's into the kind of right corner forward position. And I think it's quite late in the game where it's Murphy and Dermot Early who go up and challenge each other and bang off each other. And the two of them are lying on the ground and the ball falls to a go-away man. And I'm like, oh, that's exactly the two lads who you would have wanted in there at that stage. If one stays down and the other one knocks it down to him, then everything's going to be great. But it was a day of incoherency from a Kildare perspective.
Tommy, what's your moment of the match?
I kind of thought that Donnellan run ended a little differently than it did. I was a little bit like when it started, I was like, oh my God, it's this early. And then when it finished with, you know, it was a lovely little score, another pass and a point. I was a little bit underwhelmed that it was that moment. I thought it ended with a score, but it was his chip up a couple of minutes later. And it just kind of made him stand out as different class. The way that he just chipped that ball up, ran through. He just looked to be playing a level above other players. And to be honest, the only other player that perhaps illustrated that a little later was probably Jaff Allen in the second half. But for me, it was either that moment with Donnellan, and then there was one more moment. I'm not going to pick it as my moment of the match, but I absolutely loved Niall Finnegan's second point in the second half. It came off the back of a Donnellan run. And Anthony Rainbow can do nothing but just drag his jersey back. And there's nothing more he can do but just drag his jersey. You don't see a good jersey drag anymore in Gaelic football. So I'm going to give it to that first Donnellan point, though, when he chips up that breaking ball on the ground and saunters through and puts that ball over the bar. He just looked a different class.
The Paul Joyce goal is the moment of the match, I think. It's unbelievable. Like, you do have Michael Donnellan doing what Michael Donnellan does best, in my opinion, during this. He is the middleman. You've got John Dively, wins a free, belts it forward, and they'd started going route one to Joyce a good bit at this stage, realised it had started working. But it's Donnellan who actually just gets in the middle of this, catches this. It's an outrageously good ball from Dively. But Donnellan, we sometimes underrate the art of the hand pass, but the timing of this hand pass is perfect. He takes three Kildare men out of it. Joyce is in, rounds the keeper, back the net. It wins the All-Ireland for Galway, in my opinion. And I think from John Dively's pass forward, it's brilliant, a three-part piece of brilliance. Dively, because he's got his collar up, he's automatically 20% better at football.
I mean, that's minus for Nuxer, but Dively. Dively was great. Another one of the under-21s. It was him. It was Donlan, it was Joyce, and I can't remember who the other two was. Savage, one of them? I'm not sure. Maybe Finnegan. Finnegan's a bit older, I think. But that was why this Galway team especially came from nowhere. Like, the point about the previous Mayo team being one of the best teams in the country and it being their time that year, like, you know, would if it had been a Mayo Kildare final, can you imagine how apeshit the country would have been for, like, at last, one of these two teams is going to be reaching the promised land. And Galway came from nowhere to beat that brilliant Mayo team and knock them out first round of the Connacht Championship. The backdoor system, the absence of the backdoor was like such a chronic waste of brilliant games for a century. There's like a century's worth of what ifs because there was no backdoor system. And do you know what? Even the backdoor system, I think the next year wouldn't have allowed you win if you lost in the first round of the Championship. They were like, no, screw you. You lost in the first round, even though you're the best team in the country. It was like, it was insane.
Let's talk about that because, like, I have to stand for something that jarred at me a little bit later on, but we may as well get into it. The kind of semi-known quantity of some of these players, and like, this goes far more for Kildare than it does for Galway, because Galway obviously were back in another All-Ireland in 2000, win another All-Ireland in 2001. This is a very famous set of players, but the likes of Declan Kerrigan and Eddie McCormack, these are sort of lost names in the GAA. Excellent footballers who, like, everybody knows Dermot Early, but for a certain generation of players, there's no backlog of actually having a huge volume of games on the internet or having a huge volume of involvement at the business end of the season, because you lose in Leinster, you lose to Dublin or Meath, you're done.
You know it's possible, even in a country that has been colonised, to be a colonial wanker. That's what you're being right now, Owen. Your Kerry exceptionalism, like, oh, I've never heard of Eddie McCormack or Declan Carrigan. They're certainly in the conversation for Mount Rushmore of Kildare footballers. You're like, at least having a conversation, like, in modern era, right? They're at least getting, there's somebody there from their club whose job it is to make a recommendation for them. And eventually we'll go, no, you probably don't make it. But you going, I've never even heard of these guys. Who are these guys? Look at them.
Of course I've heard of these guys. Of course. I'm saying that they are nowhere near the level of fame that you would imagine. Say even
any
somebody,
of those. Yeah.
Like, say somebody back footballers. I don't know, talk about somebody who's been in one All-Ireland over the last 10 years. You're talking about the Tyrone players like Matty Donnelly, Colin McShane. Mm. They've been in one All-Ireland, for example. Far bigger names, just because there is one extra round, there's actually a back door. The league is far more important. Even now, even though we're doing a fraction of what we possibly can do with the product that is Gaelic Games, now it is something that is much better. It's
completely ramped up. Well, like when you think about it, I was reporting for a local Dublin radio station, and I was allowed into the dressing room afterwards for both change rooms to go and ask questions of people, and that meant that there was, like, obviously five or six other people. Maybe there might have been 10 people who were doing that same job. Now obviously the press box would be full, there'd be 100 people, and you would have in-depth analysis, and there would be stats from the league, and there would be league games on air, there'd be some now on RTE, and there'd be games on Sky and also on RTE during the summer, so you would have access to much more information about these players. Kerrigan was great, like, really.
Yeah, he was. He was super in that game.
Yeah, much better kind of controller of the game than I remembered. Eddie McCormack, that was like the archetypal Eddie McCormack performance. There was a couple of brilliant, absolutely brilliant points, and of all of the players from Kildare, he died with his boots on, but there was also a couple of bad wides mixed in with the middle of it, and that was you know, there was a live wire element to his performance that the team certainly needed. Was your question about why do we not know a bit more about this Kildare team? Essentially because it's completely unfair. If you don't win an All-Ireland, you are considered a loser. Glenn Ryan was a sensational footballer, and this game does no justice whatsoever to his career. I was thinking about this as well, about when we were talking about Seamus Moynihan the last day. Glenn Ryan is Kildare's version of Seamus Moynihan. He is as important in Kildare football as Seamus Moynihan is, but, and I'm not saying he's the same footballer or as good as him, but, like, because they didn't get over the line, he's just another of those great footballers who never won an All-Ireland. But, like, it's just not, life ain't fair.
Hmm.
I think the fact that losers get forgotten is very true there as well, but there is such a lack of great GAA documentaries. I'm not sure it can be underestimated how much of an impact Pat Comer's Year Till Sunday has on the grow that's there for these Galway footballers as well. I know they get their two All-Irelands, but, like, that documentary had a massive impact on a lot of GAA people growing up too. Like, the amount of times that's been watched by most people, it's always been on YouTube. I think it's still up on YouTube.
It is.
There's all those great lines. Derek Savage, the fastest man in Ireland. Like,
yes.
They're just like, I wanted to know. Like, I'll tell you one thing. I hated Sean Ogg the player when I was younger. He was the one man that I hated because he broke a bone in Ollie Murphy's hand in the 2001 All-Ireland final. And I wasn't able, as an 8-year-old, I wasn't able to compute, like, how that can happen in a match. I actually just thought he was a bad guy. So I always thought Sean Ogg the player was a bad guy in my head. So I really appreciated how good he was as a footballer when I watched back this All-Ireland final today. Those 2 points scored were brilliant.
In fairness, this Galway team, so they win another All-Ireland, but they also get beaten by Kerry in All-Ireland's final replay, don't they?
Yeah.
2000.
Yeah, like, those two games are two more games that the whole country are watching. And doesn't Sean Ogg the player score the greatest goal in Croke Park ever that day?
No, that was Meehan. That's Declan Meehan.
Is it Declan Meehan scores the goal?
Yeah, Declan Meehan.
Is there a pass for Sean Ogg? Is there an amazing over-the-shoulder pass?
Yeah, over-the-shoulder pass.
He's looking the wrong way. Okay, is that... Yeah.
I'm getting that up here now so we don't mess it up.
I think that all feeds into the love that people have for this Galway team as well. So it's the big games. It's the two All-Irelands. It's the lost All-Irelands. So they come back from defeat to win the next year. And it's the fact that they played such brilliant football. Like,
sorry, Ger, it's an outrageous pass from Sean Og to Prayer. I'm just watching it here.
Sean Og, over the shoulder.
It's a kick pass on the turn and unbelievable finish from Meehan, actually.
I don't mean to do Meehan a disservice, but who kicked the point after the Michael Donlan run? You can tell me now because you watched it this afternoon. But if you hadn't, and I was like, well, okay, it turns out to be Sean Og. But you wouldn't have known that, right? I remember that goal as Sean Og's first goal, and I apologise to the Meehan family, the Meehans, for mistaking it as Sean Og's goal, because in my head, it's Sean Og's. It's like, it's ridiculous.
Is it Sean Og who passed it? Why is he receiving the ball in the turn as a half forward?
Well, good point.
I think it's...
Did I get that wrong too?
That's not Sean Og the Bear, lads. Hold on.
You do have a fairly good excuse there, Ger. I want to get into secret man of the match, but like just before we get into secret man of the match, the actual man of the match in this is Michael Donlan. And like just to finish up on any last things we have to say about Donlan on this, like for me, in this game, he looks like the county minor who is at his first year minor with his county and is now playing his first game at senior level with his club. As in, the only thing that he doesn't have compared to everybody else is the stature, but he is better than everybody else. He is faster than everybody else. He is more skillful than everybody else. That is Michael Donlan in this final, in pretty much any game you see him play for Galway.
Paul Clancy played the pass to Declan Meehan.
Ah, bollocks. All right. Apologies to Paul Clancy. What's not involved at all? Right, okay.
Michael Donlan on.
He gets man of the match. So secret man of the match. Any shouts outside of Michael Donlan? I think like we've mentioned Jaff Fallon already. Like his range of scoring, absolutely fantastic.
What point are you making about Donlan then?
He's an alien being essentially.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any last thoughts on Donlan before we move on?
Where does Donlan rank amongst the Galway forwards on that day, in that six? Where do you put Michael Donlan?
Well, one or two. On the day, like, I think you can make an argument for Jaff Allen to be man of the match, given his second half performance.
I was going to pick Niall Finnegan as my man of the match. But, like, you mentioned Jaff Allen's 3 points in the second half, but, like, it's his fielding, right? There's three parts of Jaff Allen's second half performance. Those three exceptional points, there's his fielding in midfield, and then there's the fact that he feigns injury with about 5 minutes to go. There's his 3 points. He lies down. And I just say one more thing that hasn't been mentioned yet so far? Can I say one more thing? Mick Byrne played such a key role. Mm. That's unbelievable. I didn't realise that. I did not realise. I had to go back. I got lost in Google of Mick Byrne's GA credentials.
Mick Byrne giving tactical advice at one point. I was like, hang on a second. What?
Yeah, there's a great piece in the Indo from Liam Horan in 1998 describing Mick Byrne as Europe's most recognised sports physio.
Probably is.
Can you imagine? He would be Joe Wicks now with 1.6 million viewers if he'd just have been in the right generation every morning. I think Ja was not feigning injury. I think they finally realised they had to get him and they got him. I think that there was a few. John Finn was a good man for an L tackler with the elbow to the... Not Finney at one point shakes his head after one. There was one in the first minute, I think.
John Finn wins
a ball and comes out with his elbow. And the referee's like, oh, come on, that's a free. And it's like, yeah, I mean, it is. And it's a red card these days. It's like straight to that. The tackling was old school, certainly.
Well,
let's talk about these moving forwards, because this is like this is the great debate about where everybody should be versus each other. Like, Ja in the first half wasn't as good as he was in the second half. In the second half, he was as good as anybody's ever been in an All-Ireland final for 35 minutes. But Donlan, when the team needs it and they're getting completely overrun by Kildare, appears in the left cornerback situation to make that run and then kicks another few points. Joyce, I think, in the first half is like he's upright like a horse. Like, we deserve to be here. He's strutting around. Now, he in the first half, he doesn't perform like he's capable of. And in the second half, he does. And there's one really bad wide when the crowd groans. But other than that, like, Joyce is absolutely a thoroughbred. You can see it here. Like, he's announcing himself on the national stage as somebody who is going to be a really important character in football from this point forward. And that journey's not run. Like, it's very interesting to see how many of that Galway team have gone on to be involved in inter-county management versus how many of that Kildare team have. And, you know, I think that's the sliding doors moment for me, and we'll get to that in a minute. But man of the match, I absolutely think the right decision is made in giving it to Donnellan, because I think that in the first half when they needed him, and there was a chance that they might have been overrun if Kildare didn't have the Wilds disease, that the game might have got out. But Jazz second half, like if Jaff Allen was man of the match and driving away in the car, I'm like, happy days.
Yeah, it has to be one of the two of them. And I was going to ask about Port Joyce. And like, it's interesting that you describe him as a thoroughbred in his posture, but I think even in his performance as well, you can't knock Port Joyce off the ball. Like, I think there's obviously a good streak of selfishness that comes through in the second half where he blasts that terrible wide. But is that not just part of the whole Galway makeup at the time, that they're like, we're good enough? I as an individual, like speaking from Pádraig Joyce's perspective, I'm good enough. And that's what they all seem to think.
That's all that matters.
I think Joyce's performance was really good. I think when you're looking for qualities in a full forward, what you're looking for is somebody who can win their own ball, but also who isn't afraid to miss. Like, Joyce had a couple of misses. He had a couple of frees of 45 that went wide, yet he delivered. He was composed. Oh, and when you described that goal earlier on, you spoke about Dively's collar and Dively's pass and Donnellan's hand pass, and then how Joyce rounded the keeper. I don't think you can actually... I think you understated a little bit how he rounded Christy Byrne that time. It was such a gorgeous step. Like, if David Clifford or Dean Rock or Mannion or Conn was to do that nowadays, it'd be replayed.
Or Luis Suarez. And
if it was James Carr, it'd have 10 million views now already on Twitter. Like, it was just such a gorgeous step to go around the keeper and stick it in the back of the net. I just think that...
Donald's run would be the 10 million views. Like, it would be.
100%. 100%. And the sideline from Jaff Allen wouldn't be far off it either.
There were a couple of times when Donlan made a run to get a ball back and they didn't give it to him. And for history's sake, you want to go back and just tap whoever it is on the shoulder and go, give it to Michael Donlan. Hmm. Your YouTube numbers will be off the hook. Go, give it to Donlan.
Before we move on, can we just talk about those Galway six forwards? Because, like, Niall Finnegan's so good. Derek Savage, we know how electric he is. Like, if Savage buries that goal, he's at a great All-Ireland final too. Like, Finnegan is probably the leading man throughout it. And then obviously Donnellan, Jaff Allen. Like, how do you rank them? How are you supposed to stop that? How are Galway not favourites? How are Galway not favourites going into that All-Ireland final?
Well, because they're a bunch of kids. Because Michael Donnellan is a kid. Because Pádraig Joyce is a kid. That's the thing. We didn't know that they were all-time greats. We didn't know that Donnellan and Joyce were going to go on and have these careers. They were under 21s that season. Like, that's the... they weren't the Kerry under 21 team who had won two in a row. They weren't like the greatest under 21s that we've ever seen. Like, that's why. And to be honest, like, I thought Finnegan was good, but his reliability from frees was the most important thing that he had. And like, not both teams actually had fairly bad wides. And, you know, I'm talking exclusively from the Kildare side, as you can see. But like, if I was a Galway supporter and we'd lost that game in that first half, the wides in the second half, the second quarter, the second part of the first half, they were horrific. They were kicking the ball into Christy Byrne's hands just as much as Kildare were. It was like, Jesus. So I would argue the quality of this game is way below what in my mind, without having watched it back, it felt at the time like it was two absolute heavyweights, but it was two teams, Galway, searching for their identity as kids and in the backbone of the team, and Kildare, you know, we didn't know it at the time, but like, who had shot their bolt really in reaching the All-Ireland final. Like, that was wringing the last bit out from them. Jesus, that's so hard.
But like, that's one of the things that jars with me in this, is the fact that it's Kildare against Galway in an All-Ireland football final. Even watching it back, it does actually kind of feel a little bit weird that this is actually a contest directly for Sam Maguire. They've only met two times since then. One was the 2000 semi-final. The other time was that Super 8s game in 2018. It's not a noted rivalry whatsoever. They didn't play that much before this either. It was this strange moment in time when you could have an All-Ireland final like this. And that's why perhaps the occasion and the context is underrated, but perhaps the game we kind of overrate the game itself when we think about it. Like, just talking about things that jarred with you, is there anybody there that wants to lead us off? For me, it's the half-finished Croke Park. And it's still kind of...
Yes.
I can see the old Croke Park, and I can see the new Croke Park, but the half-finished Croke Park is a very strange thing to see. The perfect...
Are you talking about the sidelines?
Yeah, like the perfect roof and the Cusack stand, and then the Hogan stand still being the old version, which kind of peels around into the hill, and the old style screen on that side, but then a proper big screen on another side of the stadium. Just a half-finished stadium is just very, very unusual.
When I was thinking about most jarring, I was comparing this game in 1998 with today, 2020, what the football we're seeing nowadays, but also with the last football match that I watched, and that was the 1990 All-Ireland football final. And I think there was quite a few jarring moments from this as well. One of them is the tackling. Jerry mentioned it earlier on. There's that kind of handoff at the very first minute. I was very surprised that that was given as a free to Galway, as the Kildare defender's coming out with the ball, nails Niall Finnegan in the face, and the free is given to Galway.
That's a correct call.
It's the 90s. I thought that stuff was allowed back
then. Come on. Let him play on. Let the players play.
At Mick Lyons and Jerry McEntee fly tackling the Cork boys, and Colm O'Neill gets sent off for a wee puck, 2 weeks ago. That was one of the jarring things for me. And the second most jarring thing also relates back to 1990. Glenn Ryan is the only man of 30 with a knee brace on.
Okay.
And the last All-Ireland final I watched in 1990 had about six.
Yeah, clearly the times have changed in those 8 years. This is clearly more of a 21st century encounter.
I took a picture of Mick Byrne squirting water on, was it Michael Donlan's calf? He's like, he's literally just squirting, he had a Lucozade bottle squirting water on it. It wasn't even a magic sponge, it was just a squirt of water. That was it. It was like, I've got to. I'm like, ah, come on. What is that? What are you actually doing there? Nothing. It's like, Michael, Mick, you appear to be squirting water on my, have you any medicine?
When I saw Mick Byrne on the side, I went and did a little Google, and there's a good piece, as I mentioned, in the Indo from 98. There's a good quote. So Mick Byrne was involved with John O'Mahony all throughout most of his intercounty days. So when John O'Mahony helped Leitrim to win the Connacht title in 1994, I was involved in treating some of their injured players too. But at that time, I didn't go to the matches. So he was involved, and he must have just been going to training. He must have been busy. But he was saying that he doesn't actually go onto the field as a doctor. He lets the doctor do that job, and just after last then. But he started going to games then in 97 and 98. He won a Dublin Senior Club Football Championship medal with Clonmacnoise, and played alongside Mickey Whelan, Christy Kane, Jerry Brady and Paddy Holden on that team. And I also didn't realise that Mick Byrne was an accomplished show jumper, as well as obviously being the face of Irish Paddy soccer. 90. Yeah.
There you go. That's I didn't know that either.
Jumper.
In terms of stuff that was trending at the time, the goalie gloves. Like, I know it was a wet day beforehand, but like, why is this not a thing anymore? When did that kind of go out? Like, here on Whelan, we see the last great goalie gloves person we have. Like, it was all the rage, obviously, in 98.
What did Micheál O'Donnell have in his hands? It looked like one of those plastic gloves you see. Sean O'Donnell. What did he have? It only seemed to be on his right hand, and it looked like one of the latex gloves that people are using now to try and avoid the coronavirus. It was like, so it was see-through and it was white, and it was like, what the hell is that? So I don't know why more people didn't have goalie gloves. Like, Kieran Whelan did, and he was around that time, so I don't know why more people didn't.
Yeah,
I watched this with my kids, and they're like, the fashion's very old. And that's my 8-year-old was like, going, this looks very old. She thought it was like from ancient history, and a lot of weird hats. It is.
The hats and the flags are like, we always bang on
the
about
flags
and how GAA just doesn't have them anymore. Like,
let's bring them back. The flags are amazing. It's like, it's exactly my memory of what it was like to go to matches was like this fist infestation of flags, and it was beautiful.
Why did they ever go out of fashion? What happened? It just like with time, it just
sustainability, lads. Sustainability, that's why.
Okay.
Bamboo. The flags are bamboo. The flag thing that you hold, whatever that's called.
Stick.
Stick. Flag stick. Yeah. I was going to say staff, but it's too early in the morning. And the actual flag itself, I don't know, I presume it's cotton. But anyway, I think that it's a weapon that you're able to beat people over the head with it. I'm sure some Meath fans probably did, Tommy, and you ruined it for all of us.
Probably. Everything can be done. One last thing on the stuff that kind of jarred is the stature of a lot of the lads. Derek Savage, Donlan, Declan Kerrigan, all small lads, absolutely flying around the pitch. You don't have that volume of small lads in any intercounty game anymore. And then there was three or four, a handful of players here, which were some of the best players on the park.
Yeah, there was a big difference in 1992 where they were all, apart from Bernie Flynn, they were all massive.
Donlan's small. Donlan's quite big, isn't he? He's actually about 6 foot, I think.
Is he?
Is he?
Certainly. Wow. I'd say
that's
5'10"
if he is.
Eddie McCormick's not a huge man either, but definitely. But then, like, Kildare were a big team. If you think of Dermot Early, McCreary, Niall Buckley, Martin Lynch is over 6 feet. Obviously, Murphy when he came in, Glenn Ryan's a big man. Oh, look, what a team. I love them. I love those men.
I want to play some of the reaction because here is Ger Canning. We'll hear his voice first, I think, and then we're going to hear President of the GEA, Joe McDonough, of course, who was President at the time, and Galway captain Ray Silk. So we're getting to the parish here where Galway have won the All-Ireland and the trophy presentation is about to happen.
Sam McGuire, a brother, a captain, Walker McIlever, and Cairnmore, Jasperche, Ray Silk.
So Joe McDonough presents Sam to Ray. The West is truly awake. Galway are the All-Ireland football champions for 1998. What a day. What an occasion. Now, remember when he last received the trophy? Remember the length of the speech on that occasion? I think the Angelus will probably put back to 7 o'clock tonight. And look at the tears in the eyes. What an occasion. It's impossible not to be affected. Truly great sporting occasion. And what a moment now.
Muintir Conlon na Gaiba! Muintir Conlon! And now AB Joseph McDonough, it can't be Gottok, Leon Gottok and Kieran, Jeff Bleem, it be Gottok and Fawcett and Conlon and Craig Connock, Chris Tucker, Doe Bleem, Tasha Arnold Dom, Ogden Winter, Gulliver, and Conchar Glocka, Ogden Trasnu, Karen Sanon.
Yeah, there is Phil and his speech afterwards talking about going over to Shannon. We'll talk about the commentary in just a moment, but that mention of the Angelus in the middle of it actually kind of came as a bit of a warning because like it seems Ray Silk is being told midway through, kind of like the Oscars, to wrap up, stop talking because the Angelus is up.
Well, he said it himself. Wow. It was like they were unhappy with me the last time I was talking here on RTE. He's like clearly laying the way for his future media career. You know, always one eye on the future. And it was an excellent speech, like a proper, this is the end of a famine speech. And I thought he did a great job.
Yeah. So sorry, you were just saying there during the clip there about the co-coms.
Co-com. It was Ger Canning all on his own for the whole thing. And like, I actually don't remember when co-coms were introduced. It was obviously some kind of massive step forward. But like, there was, as far as I remember, are there no co-coms for football matches at that stage? Like, when did they start for soccer?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure because like obviously when we were watching the 1990 game back to last day, it was obviously a commentator on its own as well. Actually, that's one of the things. One thing that definitely doesn't jar with you when you listen, when you watch back this game, it's like 22 years ago and it's Ger Canning on commentary handing over to Marty Morrissey on the sideline. Yeah. It's like that could be commentary from tomorrow.
I didn't really notice. I'll be honest. I actually didn't. It didn't really click with me that Ger Canning was on his own. I don't know why I didn't notice that.
Marty Morrissey was the Aaron Andrews from ESPN of his day, was he?
Absolutely. Yes.
On the sideline. He could have used Marty a bit more. He only really used him around subs.
Well, I mean, and Marty was like, Niall Buckley has been offered a pair of boots.
Yeah.
Niall Buckley has turned down the pair of boots. Back to you, Ger.
I want to play one more clip before we wrap up today. And it's a last clip from A Year Till Sunday because there's great footage of Mick O'Dwyer in the Galway dressing room after the game, giving his speech to the Galway players, congratulating them as the gracious defeated.
Just to say a few words, lads. I know what winning is about. I know what losing is about as a player, as a good man in charge of teams. But today, lads, there was no question or doubt about it, lads. You were a better team on the day. You played marvellous football. It's 1966 since you won your last. And in 1964 and 65, he gave me some heartaches on that occasion. But today, I enjoyed it out there today, even though he beat us well. At one stage in the first half, I thought we were going to do it. We had you up to halftime, but you came out in the second half. And he gave a superb display of football for the second half. And on that, I congratulate you.
Marvellous achievement for Galway and for the West of Ireland as well as marvellous. Congratulations. Well done.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Michael.
In fairness, what a legend. Like, what an absolute legend. And I know he didn't get it done there, but I think he was so close. Like, when you consider, again, the point that I made at the very start, like, the smell of want and how far from victory Kildare have ever been, and for them to get so close to be ahead and dominant at halftime in an All-Ireland final, you know, I actually think that probably they got a lot of decisions wrong. But, like, that's, here we are 20 years later. You're making the point. There's a bit of aftertime going on about maybe Brian Murphy should have started. Like, there is, it absolutely is aftertiming. Like, that career that he put together, you said 21 All-Ireland finals, his 21st and last All-Ireland final. And then he goes on and has the best era that Laois have ever had and has, like, one of the best times that Wicklow football have ever had afterwards. Like, I think we probably do take Mikko for granted as a footballer himself and then as a manager. And, you know, like, the ability to ignite a county and to bring an entire county back to the point where they care about this enough for the smell of want to matter.
Yeah, absolutely. One last question, lads. Is this overrated or underrated? And any of your final thoughts as well?
I mean, I sent you around in the WhatsApp that Martin Brownies was like, saying this is the third best All-Ireland final. Like, it isn't. It isn't. And so, therefore, you would say it's overrated. But, like, having spoken about it for the last hour, I think that there are enough plots and subplots that, as you say, like, when you consider this is Kildare against Galway for an All-Ireland title, Sam Maguire gets handed out at the end of this game. How far away are we now from that ever being a situation that we could envisage again? Like, can you see a scenario in the next decade?
No.
Where these two teams could meet in an All-Ireland final and we'd all be like, oh, that makes perfect sense. They're the two best teams in the country.
Tailteann Cup, maybe.
There you go. You know what? Maybe we could, like, we have a situation here where currently Galway are top of the Allianz National Football League. Kildare have an All-Ireland winning manager. There's an under-20s All-Ireland win in the bank a couple of years ago. Maybe we're closer than we have been for the last 10 years. But still, that doesn't really say much for the prospects of having to sort of final again. Maybe one of these counties, I think, could go to an All-Ireland final at some point in the next
10, 15 years. You feel like Galway are pretty close to it. But, like, it's very hard, obviously, as somebody who is so heartbroken watching this again, to think of it as like this great thing that happened. But maybe it is. I don't know. Like, I mean, you, as you talk about the hipsters loving that Galway team, like, and the purists love that Galway team. That's the thing. Like, there's crossover appeal. They have broad appeal as one of the great football teams. So I can see how you can look at that. I mean, Cormac Brady's from Galway, right? So, like, certainly if Claire won that All Ireland, I'd be like, God, this is the greatest All Ireland of all time. It ends a famine. What are you talking about? So,
yeah.
But you see, it does end the famine, though, as well. Like, it ends Galway.
I know.
Famine. And, like,
I know,
if Galway hadn't won that All Ireland in 1998, perhaps Sam Maguire wouldn't have gone across the Shannon in 2001 as well. Perhaps we'd still be waiting for because you know Mayo aren't going to do it. So we might still be waiting for an All-Ireland to go across the Shannon.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think I kind of go along with that. I think the game itself, if you just watch the game back on YouTube, you'll probably think it's overrated. But then you look back at the context around this, one of the best sports documentaries that this country's ever had, one of the best teams, one of the most enjoyable teams, and a bizarre matchup, I think it's fair to say.
And Mikko.
And Mick Byrne. The two Micks and John O'Mahony, a Mayo man coming to Galway and winning an All-Ireland for them. The storylines are underrated. The game is overrated.
Is that what we're going with?
Fair enough. Storylines are definitely underrated.
We're only, for the record, we're only saying the game is overrated because of what Brandy put in paper.
So who else? I haven't seen it rated anywhere else. I haven't seen anybody else talk about it.
Well, I had shouted from the rooftops to do this game in our classic game club about a month ago. So maybe I overrated it a little bit too, but I don't think I did. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like not really happy that I watched it. Like, I was still going, what are you doing? Don't give it to him. Oh, what are you shooting for? Like, there was definitely... we're doing Tyrone against Kerry, Tyrone against Kerry, and Tyrone against Kerry for the next three, right? And
you can do a trilogy.
Sounds good.
Yeah. I've never seen these games back.
I have one last question.
Yeah.
Jared, do you remember you were saying that you were a young hack in the dressing room back in 98? Do you remember who you spoke to in the dressing room after the games that day?
I don't remember after that day specifically, but in the first round, Kildare drew against Dublin. And ordinarily, so the previous year, they'd drawn against Meath twice and then gone out the third day. And the first round in the Leinster Championship, they'd drawn against the Dubs. And I remember going into that dressing room afterwards and there was silence until Dermot Early, who was like 21 or 22 himself at that stage, spoke up and was like, "That's not the end for us. This is not going to be how our season ends. Everybody's going to say that we lost our chance today. That's not right. We had them on the rack and we're going to get them the next day." And I was looking around at all the outlaws who were kind of looking up at him going, "Geez, maybe he's right." And they did do that. Like, beating Dublin was such a big deal for them. And then beating Meath was such a big deal for them. Like, the first era of Mako being around, the only stories that we would ever hear about how the games went were like, the Dubs would be sizing up to our lads going, "What's that smell of shite off these lads?" Like, they were like you, Owen, basically. Like, looking down on the Muck Savages from Kildare, as we were at that point. And they were generally a team of Southern Kildare people, as opposed to, you know, latter days, the Northern clubs in Kildare got their shit together and started to produce inter-county players by the ton. But I actually don't remember that much about the dressing room that day, that much. Like, because I guess I was too heartbroken to take it in.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's been a worthwhile experience watching this game back. If you've got any suggestions, tweet us at Off the Ball, especially GEA suggestions. We might do this every Monday morning here on OTB AM. Ger, Tommy, thanks a million.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.